get to dedicate more time to their research. So instead of giving a leg up to parents, this policy gave a leg up to men, and at women's expense. An analysis of assistant professors hired at the top 50 US economics departments between 1985 and 2004 found that the policies ultimately led to a 22% decline in women's chances of gaining tenure at their first job. Meanwhile, men's chances increased by 19%. The analysis came in a working paper, and the totality of its findings have been challenged. But given what we already know about the disparity between mothers and fathers gaining tenure, and given what the data tells us about who actually does the care work, not to mention the gestating and giving birth and breastfeeding work, there seems little reason not to make such policies dependent on who is actually carrying the child and or who the main carer is. To date, this has not happened. This is not to say that paternity leave is not important. It certainly is. Beyond the simple matter of fairness, fathers should have the right to be involved in their children's lives, the data we have shows that properly paid paternity leave has a positive impact on female employment. At close to 80% by 2016, Sweden has the highest female employment figures in the EU. It also has one of the highest levels of paternity leave uptake in the world, with 9 out of 10 fathers taking an average of 3 to 4 months' leave. This compares with a more typical OECD level of 1 in 5 fathers taking any parental leave at all, falling to 1 in 50 in Australia, the Czech Republic, and Poland. This disparity is unsurprising. Sweden has one of the most generous and, when it was introduced, innovative paternity leave policies in the world. Since 1995, Sweden has reserved a month of parental leave, paid at 90% of earnings, exclusively for fathers. This month cannot be transferred to the mother. The father must use this leave, or the couple lose it from their overall leave allowance. In 2002, this increased to 2 months, and in 2016, it was further increased to 3 months. Prior to the introduction of the use it or lose it leave for fathers, only about 6% of men in Sweden took paternity leave, despite the fact that it had been available for them since 1974. In other words, men didn't take the leave on offer until forced to by the government. This pattern has been repeated in Iceland, where the introduction of a daddy quota doubled the amount of leave taken by men, and in South Korea, where the number of men taking leave rose more than threefold following the introduction in 2007 of a father-specific entitlement. Proving, however, that no good data goes unignored, in 2015, the UK government saw fit to introduce a shared parental leave policy with no allowance reserved exclusively for men. Predictably, the take-up has been woefully low, with just 1 in 100 men requesting leave in the 12 months after it was introduced. The introduction of a daddy quota has not been a marked success in Japan, but this is in no small part due to a design that doesn't account for either the gender pay gap or women's bodily reality. While fathers have 2 months reserved for them out of a possible 14 months of shared leave, after the first 6 months of leave, pay decreases from two-thirds of the parent's salary to just half. Given that women need to recover from pregnancy and giving birth, and maybe breastfeeding, they are most likely to take leave first, leaving the higher earner, Japanese men earn on average 27% more than Japanese women, to take the biggest salary hit. It is unsurprising, therefore, that only 2% of Japanese men take the months they are entitled to. Japan's extreme work culture likely also plays a part here. In a country where even holidays are frowned on, fathers report being shamed and penalised at work for taking parental leave. It is worth persevering, however, because the benefits of policies that enshrine in law equal parental responsibility for a child that, after all, two people have created, are long-lasting. Men who take paternity leave tend to be more involved in childcare in the future, perhaps explaining why a 2010 Swedish study found that a mother's future earnings increased by an average of 7% for every month of leave taken by the father. Evidence-based parental leave policies won't fix everything, of course, because women's unpaid workload doesn't begin and end with newborn babies, and the traditional workplace is tailored to the life of a mythical, unencumbered worker. He, and it implicitly is a he, doesn't need to concern himself with taking care of children and elderly relatives, of cooking, of cleaning, of doctor's appointments and grocery shopping and grazed knees and bullies and homework and bath time and bedtime and starting it all again tomorrow. His life is simply and easily divided into two parts, work and leisure. But a workplace predicated on the assumption that a worker can come into work every day at times and locations that are wholly unrelated to the location or opening hours of schools, childcare centres, doctors and grocery stores simply doesn't work for women. It hasn't been designed to. Some companies do try to account for the hidden male bias in the traditional workplace and workday. Campbell Soup offers on-site after-school classes and summer programmes for employees' children. Google offers a stipend for takeout meals in the first 3 months after a baby is born, subsidized childcare, and has included conveniences like dry cleaners on its campus, so employees can do their errands during the workday. Sony Ericsson and Evernote go further, paying for their employees to have their houses cleaned. Workplaces in the US increasingly provide dedicated spaces for new mothers to breast pump. American Express will even pay for women to ship their breast milk home if they have to travel for work while they are breastfeeding. But companies that remember to account for women are exceptions. When Apple announced its US HQ in 2017 as the best office building in the world, this state-of-the-art office was slated to include medical and dental treatment, luxury wellness spas, but not a child daycare center. Best office in the world for men, then? The truth is that around the world, women continue to be disadvantaged by a working culture that is based on the ideological belief that male needs are universal. The vast majority of American homemakers, 97% of whom are women, in a recent poll indicated that they would go back to work if they could work from home, 76%, or if the job offered flexible hours, 74%, rather suggesting that while the majority of US companies claim to offer flexible working, the reality is somewhat different. In fact, the number of flexible workers in the US fell between 2015 and 2016, and several major US companies are rescinding their remote work policies. In the UK, half of employees would like to work flexibly, but only 9.8% of job ads offer flexible working, and women in particular who request it report being penalised. Companies also seem to conflate long hours in the office with job effectiveness, routinely and disproportionately rewarding employees who work long hours. This constitutes a bonus for men. Statistician Nate Silver found that in the US, the hourly wage for those working 50 hours or more, 70% of whom are men, has risen twice as fast since 1984 as hourly pay for those working a more typical 35 to 49 hours per week. And this invisible male bias is exacerbated in certain countries by tax systems that exempt overtime hours from tax, a bonus for being unencumbered, that contrasts sharply with the tax relief on domestic services being trialled in Sweden. The long hours bias is particularly acute in Japan, where it is not unusual for employees to stay in the office past midnight. This is in part because promotion tends to be based on hours worked, as well as the length of time an employee has spent at a company. It also doesn't hurt to take part in nomunication, a play on the Japanese word for drinking, nomu, and the English word communication. Technically, of course, women can do all these things, but it's much more difficult for them. Japanese women spend an average of 5 hours a day on unpaid labour, compared to men who spend about an hour. It's clear who will be free to impress the boss by staying in the office till late, followed by back-slapping drinks at a local strip club. Women's unpaid workload is compounded in Japan by the two-track career options available in most big Japanese firms, career track and non-career track. The non-career track option is mainly administrative, offers few opportunities for advancement, and is known informally as the mommy track, because mommies don't fit into the kind of work culture that is required for someone on the career track. Combined with the impact having children has on a woman's chances of promotion, dependent on her ability to demonstrate loyalty through consecutive years worked at a single company, it is unsurprising that 70% of Japanese women stop working for a decade or more after they have their first child, compared to 30% of American women, with many remaining out of the workforce forever. It is also unsurprising that Japan has the sixth largest gender gap in employment and the third largest gender pay gap in the OECD. Long hours culture is also a problem in academia, and it is exacerbated by career progression systems designed around typically male life patterns. An EU report on universities in Europe pointed out that age bars on fellowships discriminate against women. Women are more likely to have had career breaks, meaning that their chronological age is older than their academic age. In an article for The Atlantic, Nicholas Wolfinger, co-author of Do Babies Matter? Gender and Family in the Ivory Tower, suggested that universities should offer part-time tenure-track positions. Primary carers can go part-time while remaining on the tenure track, in effect doubling their probationary period, with the option of going back to full-time when they can. But while some universities do offer this option, it is still rare and comes with all the poverty problems associated with care-induced part-time work elsewhere. Some women have taken matters into their own hands. In Germany, Nobel Prize-winning developmental biologist Christiane Nusslein-Volhard set up a foundation when she realised how disadvantaged her female PhD students with children were compared to their male counterparts. These women were committed researchers, and their children were in full-time care during the day. But this wasn't enough to level a field so enthralled to long hours culture. When childcare ended for the day, these women were once again encumbered. Meanwhile, their male and childless female colleagues were squeezing in extra reading or research. And so these women, committed researchers though they were dropping out. Nusslein Volhart's foundation aims to put a stop to this leaky pipeline. Honorees receive a month's stipend that they can spend on anything that alleviates their domestic load: house cleaning services, time-saving appliances like dishwashers or electric dryers, babysitters for nights and weekends when the daycare center is closed or unavailable. Recipients must be pursuing graduate or postdoctoral work at German universities. And crucially, and unlike the gender-neutral tenure extension for US academics who take parental leave, they must be women. Ideological male bias doesn't simply arise at a workplace level. It is woven into the laws that govern how employment works. For example, what counts as a work expense? This is not as objective or as gender-neutral a decision as you might think. The expenses that a company will allow its employees to claim back will generally correspond to what the country's government has decided counts as a work expense. And this in turn generally corresponds to the kinds of things men will need to claim. Uniforms and tools are in, emergency daycare is out. In the US, what is an allowable work expense is decided by the IRS, which explains that generally you cannot deduct personal, living or family expenses. But what counts as a personal expense is debatable, which is where Dawn Bavasso comes in. Bavasso is one of the few female creative directors in US advertising. She is also a single mother. So when her firm announced that it was hosting a director's dinner, Bavasso had a decision to make. Was this dinner worth the $200 it would cost her for a sitter and travel? Bavasso's male colleagues, on the whole, had to do no such mental accounting. Yes, men can be single parents, but they are a rare beast. In the UK, 90% of single parents are women. In the US, the figure is over 80%. In Bavasso's case, her male colleagues were able to just check their calendar and accept or decline. And most of them accepted. In fact, not only did they accept, they also booked the hotel next to the restaurant so they could drink. And unlike her sitter, this cost was claimable on company expenses. The implicit bias is clear. Expense codes are based on the assumption that the employee has a wife at home taking care of the home and the kids. This work doesn't need paying for because it's women's work, and women don't get paid for it. Bavasso sums it up. You can get $30 for takeout if you work late, because your wife isn't there to cook you dinner, or $30 for scotch if you want to drink your face off. But you can't get $30 for a sitter because your wife is at home with the kids. In the event, Bavasso is able to get her company to cover the cost of her childcare. But as she points out, these have been exceptions I've had to ask for, which is women all over. Always the exception, never the default. And in any case, not all employers will grant these exceptions. The Fawcett Society's 2017 report on local government in England and Wales found that despite regulations dating from 2003 that call for all councils to offer an allowance to cover the caring costs that councillors incur when fulfilling their role, in reality, provision is patchy. Some councils don't reimburse caring expenses at all, and most that do only pay a contribution. Rochdale Borough Council's scheme pays just £5.06 per hour, and specifically states that it is a contribution rather than full reimbursement of carers' expenses, although this important caveat is notably not made for travel expenses. Adding to the sense that this is a matter of priorities rather than resources, most local government meetings take place in the evening, when childcare is most likely to be needed, and although it is standard practice in many countries from the US to Sweden for councillors to remotely attend or vote at meetings, current law does not allow for this cheaper alternative. It is abundantly clear that the culture of paid work as a whole needs a radical overhaul. It needs to take into account that women are not the unencumbered workers the traditional workplace has been designed to suit, and that while men are more likely to fit into this automaton ideal, increasing numbers of them no longer want to. After all, it is simply a fact that none of us, including businesses, could do without the invisible unpaid work carers do. So it is time to stop penalising them for doing it. Instead, we must start recognising it, valuing it, and designing the paid workplace to account for it. Chapter 4. The Myth of Meritocracy. For most of the 20th century, there were no female musicians in the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. There were a couple of blips in the 1950s and 60s when a woman or two was hired, but those aside, the proportion of women sat stubbornly at zero. But then, all of a sudden, something changed. From the 1970s onwards, the numbers of female players started to go up. and up. Turnover in orchestras is extremely low. The composition of an orchestra is fairly static, at around 100 players, and when you're hired, it's often for life. It's rare that a musician is fired. So there was something remarkable going on when the proportion of women in this orchestra grew from a statistical 0% to 10% in a decade. That something was blind auditions. Instituted in the early 1970s following a lawsuit, blind auditions are what they sound like. The hiring committee can't see who is playing in the audition because there is a screen between them and the player. The screens had an immediate impact. By the early 1980s, women began to make up 50% of the share of new hires. Today, the proportion of female musicians in the New York Philharmonic stands at over 45%. The simple step of installing a screen turned the audition process for the New York Philharmonic into a meritocracy. But in this, it is an outlier. For the vast majority of hiring decisions around the world, meritocracy is an insidious myth. It is a myth that provides cover to institutional white male bias. And dishearteningly, it is a myth that proves remarkably resistant to all the evidence going back decades that shows it up as the fantasy it most certainly is. If we want to kill this myth off, we're clearly going to have to do more than just collect data. The fact that meritocracy is a myth is not a popular one. Around the industrialized world, people believe that not only is meritocracy the way things should work, it's the way things do work. Despite evidence suggesting that, if anything, the US is less meritocratic than other industrialized countries, Americans in particular hold on to meritocracy as an article of faith, and employment and promotion strategies over the past few decades have increasingly been designed as if meritocracy is a reality. A survey of US firms found that 95% used performance evaluations in 2002, compared to 45% in 1971, and 90% had a merit-based pay plan in place. The problem is, there is little evidence that these approaches actually work. In fact, there is strong evidence that they don't. An analysis of 248 performance reviews collected from a variety of US-based tech companies found that women receive negative personality criticism that men simply don't. Women are told to watch their tone, to step back. They are called bossy, abrasive, strident, aggressive, emotional, and irrational. Out of all these words, only aggressive appeared in men's reviews at all, twice with an exhortation to be more of it. More damningly, several studies of performance-related bonuses or salary increases have found that white men are rewarded at a higher rate than equally performing women and ethnic minorities, with one study of a financial corporation uncovering a 25% difference in performance-based bonuses between women and men in the same job. The myth of meritocracy achieves its apotheosis in America's tech industry. According to a 2016 survey, the number one concern of tech startup founders was hiring good people, while having a diverse workforce ranked 7th on the list of 10 business priorities. 1 in 4 founders said they weren't interested in diversity or work-life balance at all, which, taken together, points to a belief that if you want to find the best people, addressing structural bias is unnecessary. A belief in meritocracy is all you need. Actually, a belief in meritocracy may be all you need, to introduce bias, that is. Studies have shown that a belief in your own personal objectivity, or a belief that you are not sexist, makes you less objective and more likely to behave in a sexist way. Men, women were not found to exhibit this bias, who believe they are objective in hiring decisions, are more likely to hire a male applicant than an identically described female applicant. And in organizations which are explicitly presented as meritocratic, managers favor male employees over equally qualified female employees. Tech's love affair with the myth of meritocracy is ironic for an industry so enthralled to the potential of big data, because this is a rare case where the data actually exists. But if in Silicon Valley, meritocracy is a religion, its god is a white male Harvard dropout, and so are most of his disciples. Women make up only 1/4 of the tech industry's employees and 11% of its executives. This is despite women earning more than 1/2 of all undergraduate degrees in the US, 1/2 of all undergraduate degrees in chemistry, and almost 1/2 in maths. More than 40% of women leave tech companies after 10 years, compared to 17% of men. A report by the Center for Talent Innovation found that women didn't leave for family reasons or because they didn't enjoy the work. They left because of workplace conditions, undermining behavior from managers, and a sense of feeling stalled in one's career. A feature for the Los Angeles Times similarly found that women left because they were repeatedly passed up for promotion and had their projects dismissed. Does this sound like a meritocracy, or does it look more like institutionalized bias? That the myth of meritocracy survives in the face of such statistics is testament to the power of the male default. In the same way that men picture a man 80% of the time they think of a person, it's possible that many men in the tech industry simply don't notice how male-dominated it is. But it's also testament to the attractiveness of a myth that tells the people who benefit from it that all their achievements are down to their own personal merit. It is no accident that those who are most likely to believe in the myth of meritocracy are young, upper-class, white Americans. If white upper-class Americans are most likely to believe in the myth of meritocracy, it should come as no surprise that academia is, like tech, a strong follower of the religion. The upper ranks of academia, particularly those of science, technology, engineering and maths, STEM, are dominated by white, middle and upper-class men. It is a perfect petri dish for the myth of meritocracy to flourish in. Accordingly, a recent study found that male academics, particularly those in STEM, rated fake research claiming that academia had no gender bias higher than real research, which showed it did. Also accordingly, gender bias is in fact plentiful and well documented. Numerous studies from around the world have found that female students and academics are significantly less likely than comparable male candidates to receive funding, be granted meetings with professors, be offered mentoring, or even to get the job. Where mothers are seen as less competent and often paid less, being a father can work in a man's favour, a gendered bias that is by no means restricted to academia. But despite the abundance of data showing that academia is in fact far from meritocratic, universities continue to proceed as if male and female students and male and female academics are operating on a level playing field. Career progression in academia depends largely on how much you get published in peer-reviewed journals, but getting published is not the same feat for men as it is for women. A number of studies have found that female-authored papers are accepted more often or rated higher under double-blind review when neither author nor reviewer are identifiable. And although the evidence varies on this point, given the abundant male bias that has been identified in academia, there seems little reason not to institute this form of blind academic audition. Nevertheless, most journals and conferences carry on without adopting this practice. Of course, female academics do get published, but that's only half the battle. Citation is often a key metric in determining research impact, which in turn determines career progression, and several studies have found that women are systematically cited less than men. Over the past 20 years, men have self-cited 70% more than women, and women tend to cite other women more than men do, meaning that the publication gap is something of a vicious circle. Fewer women getting published leads to a citations gap, which in turn means fewer women progress as they should in their careers, and around again we go. The citations gap is further compounded by male default thinking. As a result of the widespread academic practice of using initials rather than full names, the gender of academics is often not immediately obvious, leading female academics to be assumed to be male. One analysis found that female scholars are cited as if they are male by colleagues who have assumed the P stands for Paul rather than Pauline more than 10 times more often than vice versa. Writing for the New York Times, economist Justin Wolfers noted a related male default habit in journalists routinely referring to the male contributor as the lead author, when in fact the lead author was a woman. This lazy product of male default thinking is inexcusable in a media report. But it's even more unacceptable in academia, and yet here too it proliferates. In economics, joint papers are the norm, and joint papers contain a hidden male bias. Men receive the same level of credit for both solo and joint papers, but unless they are writing with other female economists, women receive less than half as much credit for co-authored papers as men do. This, a US study contends, explains why, although female economists publish as much as male economists are twice as likely to receive tenure. Male default thinking may also be behind the finding that research perceived to have been done by men is associated with greater scientific quality. This could be a product of pure sexism, but it could also be a result of the mode of thinking that sees male as universal and female as niche. It would certainly go some way to explaining why women are less likely to appear on course syllabuses. Of course, before a woman gets to face all these hidden hurdles, she must have found the time to do the research in the first place, and that is by no means a given. We've already discussed how women's unpaid workload outside of paid employment impacts on their ability to do research. But their unpaid workload inside the workplace doesn't help either. When students have an emotional problem, it is their female professors, not their male professors, they turn to. Students are also more likely to request extensions, grade boosts, and rule bending of female academics. In isolation, a request of this kind isn't likely to take up much time or mental energy, but they add up, and they constitute a cost on female academics' time that male academics mostly aren't even aware of, and that universities don't account for. Women are also asked to do more undervalued admin work than their male colleagues. And they say yes, because they are penalized for being unlikable if they say no. This is a problem across a range of workplaces. Women, and in particular ethnic minority women, do the housekeeping, taking notes, getting the coffee, cleaning up after everyone, in the office as well as at home. Women's ability to publish is also impacted by their being more likely than their male colleagues to get loaded with extra teaching hours, and, like honorary admin posts, teaching is viewed as less important, less serious, less valuable than research. And we run into another vicious circle here. Women's teaching load prevents them from publishing enough, which results in more teaching hours, and so on. The inequity of women being loaded with less valued work is compounded by the system for evaluating this work, because it is itself systematically biased against women. Teaching evaluation forms are widely used in higher education, and they represent another example of a situation where we have the data, but are simply ignoring it. Decades of research in numerous countries shows that teaching evaluation forms are worse than useless at actually evaluating teaching, and are in fact biased against female instructors by an amount that is large and statistically significant. They are, however, pretty good at evaluating gender bias. One of these biases is our old friend, men are the default human, which shows up in objections to female lecturers straying away from a focus on white men. I didn't come out of this course with any more information except gender and race struggles than I came in with, complained one student who apparently felt that race and gender were not relevant to the topic at hand, US Confederation. Falling into the trap we encountered in the introduction of not realizing that people is as likely to mean women as it is to mean men, another student complained that, although Andrea stated on the first day she would teach a people's perspective, it was not illustrated how much was going to be focused on First Nation and women's history. Incidentally, it's worth taking the implication that this lecturer focused almost exclusively on First Nations and women's history with a pinch of salt. A friend of mine got a similarly unhappy review from a male student for focusing too much on feminism in her political philosophy lectures. She had spoken about feminism once in 10 classes. Less effective male professors routinely receive higher student evaluations than more effective female teachers. Students believe that male professors hand marking back more quickly, even when that is impossible because it's an online course delivered by a single lecturer, but where half the students are led to believe that the professor is male and half female. Female professors are penalised if they aren't deemed sufficiently warm and accessible, but if they are warm and accessible, they can be penalised for not appearing authoritative or professional. On the other hand, appearing authoritative and knowledgeable as a woman can result in student disapproval because this violates gendered expectations. Meanwhile, men are rewarded if they are accessible at a level that is simply expected in women and therefore only noticed if it's absent. An analysis of 14 million reviews on the website ratemyprofessors.com found that female professors are more likely to be mean, harsh, unfair, strict, and annoying. And it's getting worse. Female instructors have stopped reading their evaluations in droves, as student comments have become increasingly aggressive and at times violent. A female political history lecturer at a Canadian university received the following useful feedback from her student. "I like how your nipples show through your bra. Thanks." The lecturer in question now wears lightly padded bras exclusively. The teaching evaluation study that revealed women are more likely to be mean also found that male professors are more likely to be described as brilliant, intelligent, smart, and a genius. But were these men actually more in possession of raw talent than their female counterparts? Or is it just that these words are not as gender neutral as they appear? Think of a genius. Chances are you pictured a man. It's okay. We all have these unconscious biases. I pictured Einstein, that famous one of him sticking his tongue out, his hair all over the place. And the reality is that this bias, that I like to call brilliance bias, means that male professors are routinely considered more knowledgeable, more objective, more innately talented. And career progression that rests on teaching evaluations completely fails to account for it. Brilliance bias is in no small part a result of a data gap. We have written so many female geniuses out of history, they just don't come to mind as easily. The result is that when brilliance is considered a requirement for a job, What is really meant is a penis. Several studies have found that the more a field is culturally understood to require brilliance or raw talent to succeed, think philosophy, maths, physics, music composition, computer science, the fewer women there will be studying and working in it. We just don't see women as naturally brilliant. In fact, we seem to see femininity as inversely associated with brilliance. A recent study where participants were shown photos of male and female science faculty at elite US universities also found that appearance had no impact on how likely it was that a man would be judged to be a scientist. When it came to women, however, the more stereotypically feminine they looked, the less likely it was that people would think they were a scientist. We teach brilliance bias to children from an early age. A recent US study found that when girls start primary school at the age of 5, they are as likely as 5-year-old boys to think women could be really, really smart. But by the time they turn 6, something changes. They start doubting their gender. So much so, in fact, that they start limiting themselves. If a game is presented to them as intended for children who are really, really smart, 5-year-old girls are as likely to want to play it as boys. But 6-year-old girls are suddenly uninterested. Schools are teaching little girls that brilliance doesn't belong to them. No wonder that by the time they're filling out university evaluation forms, students are primed to see their female teachers as less qualified. Schools are also teaching brilliance bias to boys. As we saw in the introduction, following decades of Draw a Scientist studies where children overwhelmingly drew men, a recent Draw a Scientist meta-analysis was celebrated across the media as showing that finally we were becoming less sexist. Where in the 1960s only 1% of children drew female scientists, 28% do now. This is, of course, an improvement, but it is still far off reality. In the UK, women actually outnumber men in a huge range of science degrees. 86% of those studying polymers, 57% of those studying genetics, and 56% of those studying microbiology are female. And in any case, the results are actually more complicated than the headlines suggest, and still provide damning evidence that data gaps in school curriculums are teaching children biases. When children start school, they draw roughly equal percentages of male and female scientists, averaged out across boys and girls. By the time children are 7 or 8, male scientists significantly outnumber female scientists. By the age of 14, children are drawing 4 times as many male scientists as female scientists. So although more female scientists are being drawn, much of the increase has been in younger children before the education system teaches them data gap-informed gender biases. There was also a significant gender difference in the change. Between 1985 to 2016, the average percentage of female scientists drawn by girls rose from 33% to 58%. The respective figures for boys were 2.4% and 13%. This discrepancy may shed some light on the finding of a 2016 study, which found that while female students ranked their peers according to actual ability, male biology students consistently ranked their fellow male students as more intelligent than better performing female students. Brilliance bias is one hell of a drug. And it doesn't only lead to students misevaluating their teachers or each other. There is also evidence that teachers are misevaluating their students. Several studies conducted over the past decade or so show that letters of recommendation are another seemingly gender-neutral part of a hiring process that is in fact anything but. One US study found that female candidates are described with more communal, warm, kind, nurturing, and less active, ambitious, self-confident language than men. And having communal characteristics included in your letter of recommendation makes it less likely that you will get the job, particularly if you're a woman. While team player is taken as a leadership quality in men, for women, the term can make a woman seem like a follower. Letters of recommendation for women have also been found to emphasize teaching, lower status, over research, higher status, to include more terms that raise doubt, hedges, faint praise, and to be less likely to include standout adjectives like remarkable and outstanding. Women were more often described with grindstone terms like hardworking. There is a data gap at the heart of universities using teacher evaluations and letters of recommendation as if they are gender neutral in effect as well as in application. Although, like the meritocracy data gap more broadly, it is not a gap that arises from a lack of data so much as a refusal to engage with it. Despite all the evidence, letters of recommendation and teaching evaluations continue to be heavily weighted and used widely in hiring, promoting, and firing as if they are objective tests of worth. In the UK, student evaluations are set to become even more important when the Teaching Excellence Framework, TEF, is introduced in 2020. The TEF will be used to determine how much funding a university can receive, and the National Student Survey will be considered a key metric of teaching success. Women can expect to be penalised heavily in this excellent teaching new world. The lack of meritocracy in academia is a problem that should concern all of us if we care about the quality of the research that comes out of the academy, because studies show that female academics are more likely than men to challenge male default analysis in their work. This means that the more women who are publishing, the faster the gender data gap in research will close. And we should care about the quality of academic research. This is not an esoteric question, relevant only to those who inhabit the ivory towers. The research produced by the academy has a significant impact on government policy, on medical practice, on occupational health legislation. The research produced by the academy has a direct impact on all of our lives. It matters that women are not forgotten here. Given the evidence that children learn brilliance bias at school, it should be fairly easy to stop teaching them this. And in fact, a recent study found that female students perform better in science when the images in their textbooks include female scientists. So to stop teaching girls that brilliance doesn't belong to them, we just need to stop misrepresenting women. Easy. It's much harder to correct for brilliance bias once it's already been learnt, however. And once children who've been taught it grow up and enter the world of work, they often start perpetuating it themselves. This is bad enough when it comes to human-on-human recruitment. But with the rise of algorithm-driven recruiting, the problem is set to get worse, because there is every reason to suspect that this bias is being unwittingly hardwired into the very code to which we're outsourcing our decision-making. In 1984, American tech journalist Stephen Levy published his best-selling book, Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution. Levy's heroes were all brilliant. They were all single-minded. They were all men. They also didn't get laid much. You would hack and you would live by the hacker ethic, and you knew that horribly inefficient and wasteful things like women burned too many cycles, occupied too much memory space, Levy explained. Women, even today, are considered grossly unpredictable, one of his heroes told him. How can a default male hacker tolerate such an imperfect being? Two paragraphs after having reported such blatant misogyny, Levy nevertheless found himself at a loss to explain why this culture was more or less exclusively male. The sad fact was that there was never a star quality female hacker, he wrote. No one knows why. I don't know, Steve. We can probably take a wild guess. By failing to make the obvious connection between an openly misogynistic culture and the mysterious lack of women, Levy contributed to the myth of innately talented hackers being implicitly male. And today, it's hard to think of a profession more enthralled to brilliance bias than computer science. Where are the girls that love to program? Asked a high school teacher who took part in a summer program for advanced placement computer science teachers at Carnegie Mellon. I have any numbers of boys who really love computers, he mused. Several parents have told me their sons would be on the computer programming all night if they could. I have yet to run into a girl like that. This may be true, but as one of his fellow teachers pointed out, failing to exhibit this behaviour doesn't mean that his female students don't love computer science. Recalling her own student experience, she explained how she fell in love with programming when she took her first course in college. But she didn't stay up all night or even spend a majority of her time programming. Staying up all night doing something is a sign of single-mindedness and possibly immaturity as well as love for the subject. The girls may show their love for computers and computer science very differently. If you are looking for this type of obsessive behaviour, then you are looking for a typically young male behaviour. While some girls will exhibit it, most won't. Beyond its failure to account for female socialisation, girls are penalised for being antisocial in a way boys aren't, the odd thing about framing an aptitude for computer science around typically male behaviour is that coding was originally seen as a woman's game. In fact, women were the original computers, doing complex maths problems by hand for the military before the machine that took their name replaced them. Even after they were replaced by a machine, it took years before they were replaced by men. ENIAC, the world's first fully functional digital computer, was unveiled in 1946, having been programmed by six women. During the 1940s and 50s, women remained the dominant sex in programming. And in 1967, Cosmopolitan magazine published The Computer Girls, an article encouraging women into programming. It's just like planning a dinner, explained computer pioneer Grace Hopper. You have to plan ahead and schedule everything so that it's ready when you need it. Programming requires patience and the ability to handle detail. Women are naturals at computer programming. But it was in fact around this time that employers were starting to realize that programming was not the low-skilled clerical job they had once thought. It wasn't like typing or filing. It required advanced problem-solving skills. And brilliance bias being more powerful than objective reality, given women were already doing the programming, they clearly had these skills, industry leaders started training men. And then they developed hiring tools that seemed objective, but were actually covertly biased against women. Rather like the teaching evaluations in use in universities today, these tests have been criticized as telling employers less about an applicant's suitability for the job than his or her possession of frequently stereotyped characteristics. It's hard to know whether these hiring tools were developed as a result of a gender data gap, not realizing that the characteristics they were looking for were male-biased, or a result of direct discrimination, but what is undeniable is that they were biased towards men. Multiple-choice aptitude tests, which required little nuance or context-specific problem-solving, focused instead on the kind of mathematical trivia that even then industry leaders were seeing as increasingly irrelevant to programming. What they were mainly good at testing was the type of math skills men were, at the time, more likely to have studied at school. They also were quite good at testing how well-networked an applicant was. The answers were frequently available through all-male networks like college fraternities and Elks Lodges, a US-based fraternal order. Personality profiles formalized the programmer stereotype, nodded to by the computer science teacher at the Carnegie Mellon program, the geeky loner with poor social and hygiene skills. A widely quoted 1967 psychological paper had identified a disinterest in people and a dislike of activities involving close personal interaction as a striking characteristic of programmers. As a result, companies sought these people out, they became the top programmers of their generation, and the psychological profile became a self-fulfilling prophecy. This being the case, it should not surprise us to find this kind of hidden bias enjoying a resurgence today, courtesy of the secretive algorithms that have been increasingly involved in the hiring process. Writing for The Guardian, Cathy O'Neill, the American data scientist and author of Weapons of Math Destruction, explains how online tech hiring platform Guild, which has now been bought and brought in-house by investment firm Citadel, enables employers to go well beyond a job applicant's CV by combing through their social data. That is, the trace they leave behind them online. This data is used to rank candidates by social capital, which basically refers to how integral a programmer is to the digital community. This can be measured through how much time they spend sharing and developing code on development platforms like GitHub or Stack Overflow. But the mountains of data Guild sifts through also reveal other patterns. For example, according to Guild's data, frequenting a particular Japanese manga site is a solid predictor of strong coding. Programmers who visit this site therefore receive higher scores. Which all sounds very exciting, but as O'Neill points out, awarding marks for this rings immediate alarm bells for anyone who cares about diversity. Women, who as we have seen do 75% of the world's unpaid care work, may not have the spare leisure time to spend hours chatting about manga online. O'Neill also points out that if, like most of techdom, that manga site is dominated by males and has a sexist tone, a good number of the women in the industry will probably avoid it. In short, Guild seems to be something like the algorithm form of the male computer science teacher from the Carnegie program. Guild undoubtedly did not intend to create an algorithm that discriminated against women. They were intending to remove human biases. But if you aren't aware of how those biases operate, if you aren't collecting data and taking a little time to produce evidence-based processes, you will continue to blindly perpetuate old injustices. And so, by not considering the ways in which women's lives differ from men's, both on and offline, Guild's coders inadvertently created an algorithm with a hidden bias against women. But that's not even the most troubling bit. The most troubling bit is that we have no idea how bad the problem actually is. Most algorithms of this kind are kept secret and protected as proprietary code. This means that we don't know how these decisions are being made and what biases they are hiding. The only reason we know about this potential bias in Guild's algorithm is because one of its creators happened to tell us. This, therefore, is a double gender data gap, first in the knowledge of the coders designing the algorithm, and second in the knowledge of society at large about just how discriminatory these AIs are. Employment procedures that are unwittingly biased towards men are an issue in promotion as well as hiring. A classic example comes from Google, where women weren't nominating themselves for promotion at the same rate as men. This is unsurprising. Women are conditioned to be modest and are penalized when they step outside this prescribed gender norm. But Google was surprised. And to do them credit, they set about trying to fix it. Unfortunately, the way they went about fixing it was quintessential male default thinking. It's not clear whether Google didn't have or didn't care about the data on the cultural expectations that are imposed on women, but either way, their solution was not to fix the male bias system, it was to fix the women. Senior women at Google started hosting workshops to encourage women to nominate themselves, Laszlo Bock, head of people operations, told the New York Times in 2012. In other words, they held workshops to encourage women to be more like men. But why should we accept that the way men do things, the way men see themselves, is the correct way? Recent research has emerged showing that while women tend to assess their intelligence accurately, men of average intelligence think they are more intelligent than two-thirds of people. This being the case, perhaps it wasn't that women's rates of putting themselves up for promotion were too low. Perhaps it was that men's were too high. Bock claimed Google's workshops as a success. He told the New York Times that women are now promoted proportionally to men. But if that is the case, why the reluctance to provide the data to prove it? When the US Department of Labor conducted an analysis of Google's pay practices in 2017, it found systemic compensation disparities against women pretty much across the entire workforce, with 6 to 7 standard deviations between pay for men and women in nearly every job category. Google has since repeatedly refused to hand over fuller pay data to the Labor Department, fighting in court for months to avoid the demand. There was no pay imbalance, they insisted. For a company built almost entirely on data, Google's reluctance to engage here may seem surprising. It shouldn't be. Software engineer Tracy Chu has been investigating the number of female engineers in the US tech industry since 2013 and has found that every company has some way of hiding or muddling the data. They also don't seem interested in measuring whether or not their initiatives to make the work environment more female-friendly or to encourage more women to go into or stay in computing are actually successful. There's no way of judging whether they're successful or worth mimicking because there are no success metrics attached to any of them, explains Chu. And the result is that nobody is having honest conversations about the issue. It's not entirely clear why the tech industry is so afraid of sex-disaggregated employment data, but its love affair with the myth of meritocracy might have something to do with it. If all you need to get the best people is to believe in meritocracy, what use is data to you? The irony is, if these so-called meritocratic institutions actually valued science over religion, they could make use of the evidence-based solutions that do already exist. For example, quotas, which, contrary to popular misconception, were recently found by a London School of Economics study to weed out incompetent men rather than promote unqualified women. They could also collect and analyse data on their hiring procedures to see whether these are as gender-neutral as they think. MIT did this, and their analysis of over 30 years of data found that women were disadvantaged by usual departmental hiring processes, and that exceptional women candidates might very well not be found by conventional departmental search committee methods. Unless search committees specifically ask department heads for names of outstanding female candidates, they may not put women forward. Many women who were eventually hired when special efforts were made to specifically find female candidates would not have applied for the job without encouragement. In line with the LSE findings, the paper also found that standards were not lowered during periods when special effort was made to hire women. In fact, if anything, the women that were hired are somewhat more successful than their male peers. The good news is that when organisations do look at the data and attempt to act on it, the results can be dramatic. When a European company advertised for a technical position using a stock photo of a man alongside copy that emphasised aggressiveness and competitiveness, only 5% of the applicants were women. When they changed the ad to a stock photo of a woman and focused the text on enthusiasm and innovation, the number of women applying shot up to 40%. Digital design company Made by Many found a similar shift when they changed the wording of their ad for a senior design role to focus more on teamwork and user experience and less on bombastic single-minded egotism. The role was the same, but the framing was different, and the number of female applicants more than doubled. These are just two anecdotes, but there is plenty of evidence that the wording of an ad can impact on women's likelihood to apply for a job. A study of 4,000 job ads found that women were put off from applying for jobs that used wording associated with masculine stereotypes such as aggressive, ambitious, or persistent. Significantly, women didn't consciously note the language or realise it was having this impact on them. They rationalised the lack of appeal, putting it down to personal reasons, which goes to show that you don't have to realise you're being discriminated against to in fact be discriminated against. Several tech startups have also taken a leaf out of the New York Philharmonic's book and developed blind recruitment systems. Gap Jumpers gives job applicants mini assignments designed for a specific post, and the top performing applicants are sent to hiring managers without any identifying information. The result? Around 60% of those selected end up coming from underrepresented backgrounds. Tech recruiter Speak With A Geek found a similarly dramatic result when they presented the same 5,000 candidates to the same group of employers on two different occasions. The first time, details like names, experience, and background were provided. 5% selected for interviews were women. The second time, those details were suppressed. The proportion of women selected for interview was 54%. While blind recruitment might work for the initial hiring process, it's less easy to see how it could be incorporated into promotions. But there is a solution here too: accountability and transparency. One tech company made managers truly accountable for their decisions on salary increases by collecting data on all their decisions and, crucially, appointing a committee to monitor this data. 5 years after adopting this system, the pay gap had all but disappeared. Chapter 5. The Henry Higgins Effect. When Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg got pregnant for the first time, she was working at Google. "My pregnancy was not easy," she wrote in her best-selling book, Lean In. She had morning sickness for the whole 9 months. She didn't just develop a bump, her whole body was swollen. Her feet went up two sizes, turning into odd-shaped lumps I could see only when they were propped up on a coffee table. It was 2014, and Google was already a huge company, with a huge car park, one that Sandberg found increasingly difficult to walk across in her swollen state. After months of struggling, she finally went to one of Google's founders, Sergey Brin, and announced that we needed pregnancy parking at the front of the building, preferably sooner rather than later. Brin agreed immediately, noting that he had never thought about it before. Sandberg herself was embarrassed she hadn't realized that pregnant women needed reserve parking until I experienced my own aching feet. What Google had suffered from until Sandberg became pregnant was a data gap. Neither Google's male founders nor Sandberg had ever been pregnant before. As soon as one of them did get pregnant, that data gap was filled, and all the women who got pregnant at the company after that would benefit from it. It shouldn't have taken a senior woman getting pregnant for Google to fill this data gap. There had been pregnant women working at the company before. Google could and should have been proactive in searching that data out. But the reality is that it usually does take a senior woman for problems like this to be fixed. And so, because business leadership is still so dominated by men, modern workplaces are riddled with these kinds of gaps, from doors that are too heavy for the average woman to open with ease, to glass stairs and lobby floors that mean anyone below can see up your skirt, to paving that's exactly the right size to catch your heels. Small, niggling issues that aren't the end of the world, granted, but that nevertheless irritate. Then there's the standard office temperature. The formula to determine standard office temperature was developed in the 1960s around the metabolic resting rate of the average 40-year-old 70-kilogram man. But a recent study found that the metabolic rate of young adult females performing light office work is significantly lower than the standard values for men doing the same type of activity. In fact, the formula may overestimate female metabolic rate by as much as 35%, meaning that current offices are on average 5 degrees too cold for women, which leads to the odd sight of female office workers wrapped up in blankets in the New York summer while their male colleagues wander around in summer clothes. These data gaps are all inequitable, not to mention being bad business sense. An uncomfortable workforce is an unproductive workforce. But workplace data gaps lead to a lot worse than simple discomfort and consequent inefficiency. Sometimes they lead to chronic illness. Sometimes they mean women die. Over the past 100 years, workplaces have, on the whole, got considerably safer. In the early 1900s, around 4,400 people in the UK died at work every year. By 2016, that figure had fallen to 137. In the US, around 23,000 people, out of a workforce of 38 million, died at work in 1913. In 2016, 5,190 people died out of a workforce of 163 million. This significant decrease in fatal accidents has largely been the result of unions pressuring employers and governments to improve safety standards. Since the 1974 Health and Safety at Work Act, workplace fatalities in the UK have dropped by 85%. But there is a caveat to this good news story. While serious injuries at work have been decreasing for men, there is evidence that they have been increasing among women. The rise in serious injuries among female workers is linked to the gender data gap. With occupational research traditionally having been focused on male-dominated industries, our knowledge of how to prevent injuries in women is patchy, to say the least. We know all about heavy lifting and construction, what the weight limits should be, how it can be done safely. But when it comes to heavy lifting and care work, well, that's just women's work, and who needs training for that? Béatrice Boulanger didn't get any training. As a home helper for older people, she learnt everything on the job. But her duties included a lot of lifting, often of overweight people. One day, as she was helping a woman out of the bath, her shoulder gave way. Everything around the joint was crumbling, she told occupational health magazine Hazards. The doctors had to cut off the head of my humerus. Boulanger eventually needed a full shoulder replacement, and she can no longer do her job. Boulanger is not a one-off. Women working as carers and cleaners can lift more in a shift than a construction worker or a miner. We only got a sink upstairs 3 years ago, a cleaner at a cultural centre in France told the Equal Times. Before that, we had to carry buckets of water upstairs and down again when the water was dirty. Nobody realised. And unlike the construction workers and miners, these women often don't go home to rest, but instead go home to a second unpaid shift, where there is more lifting, more lugging, more crouching and scrubbing. In her 2018 retrospective of a lifetime spent researching women's occupational health, Karen Messing, a geneticist and professor of biological sciences at Montreal University, writes that there has still been no biomechanics research on the effects of breast size on lifting techniques associated with back pain, despite the fact that engineer Angela Tate of Memorial University alerted scientists to male bias in biomechanical studies back in the 1990s. Messing also points to women's reports of work-related musculoskeletal pain still being treated with skepticism, despite accumulating reports that pain systems function differently among women and men. Meanwhile, we've only just noticed that nearly all pain studies have been done exclusively in male mice. The gender data gap in occupational health is sometimes attributed to the fact that men are more likely than women to die on the job. But while it is true that the most dramatic accidents are still dominated by male workers, this isn't the full story, because an accident at work is by no means the only way your job can kill you. In fact, it's not even the most common way your job can kill you, not by a long shot. Every year, 8,000 people die from work-related cancers. And although most research in this area has been done on men, it's far from clear that men are the most affected. Over the past 50 years, breast cancer rates in the industrialized world have risen significantly. But a failure to research female bodies, occupations, and environments means that the data for exactly what is behind this rise is lacking. We know everything about dust disease in miners, Rory O'Neill, Professor of Occupational and Environmental Policy Research at the University of Stirling, tells me. You can't say the same for exposures, physical or chemical, in women's work. This is partly a historical problem. For many long-latency diseases, like cancer, explains O'Neill, it can be decades before the pile of bodies gets big enough to reach a conclusion. We've been counting the bodies in traditional men's jobs, mining, construction, for several generations. Specifically, we've been counting male bodies. When women did work in those industries or had similar exposures, they were often discounted from studies as confounding factors. Meanwhile, in most female-dominated industries, the studies simply weren't done at all. So even if we started the studies now, says O'Neill, it would take a working generation before we had any usable data. But we aren't starting the studies now. Instead, we continue to rely on data from studies done on men as if they apply to women. Specifically, Caucasian men aged 25 to 30 who weigh 70 kilograms. This is reference man, and his superpower is being able to represent humanity as a whole. Of course, he does not. Men and women have different immune systems and different hormones, which can play a role in how chemicals are absorbed. Women tend to be smaller than men and have thinner skin, both of which can lower the level of toxins they can be safely exposed to. This lower tolerance threshold is compounded by women's higher percentage of body fat, in which some chemicals can accumulate. The result is that levels of radiation that are safe for reference man turn out to be anything but for women. Ditto for a whole range of commonly used chemicals. And yet, the male default one-level-to-rule-them-all approach persists. This is made worse by the way chemicals are tested. To start with, chemicals are still usually tested in isolation and on the basis of a single exposure. But this is not how women tend to encounter them, either at home, in cleaning products and cosmetics, or in the workplace. In nail salons, where the workforce is almost exclusively female and often migrant, workers will be exposed on a daily basis to a huge range of chemicals that are routinely found in the polishes, removers, gels, shellacs, disinfectants, and adhesives that are the staples of their work. Many of these chemicals have been linked to cancer, miscarriages, and lung diseases. Some may alter the body's normal hormonal functions. After a shift of paid work, many of these women will then go home and begin a second unpaid shift, where they will be exposed to different chemicals that are ubiquitous in common cleaning products. The effects of these chemicals mixing together are largely unknown, although research does indicate that exposure to a mixture of chemicals can be much more toxic than exposure to chemicals on an individual basis. Most of the research on chemicals has focused on their absorption through the skin. Leaving aside the problem that absorption through thicker male skin may not be the same as for women, skin is by no means the only way women working in nail salons will be absorbing these chemicals. Many of them are extremely volatile, which means that they evaporate into the air at room temperature and can be inhaled, along with the considerable amounts of dust produced when acrylic nails are filed. The research on how this may impact on workers is virtually non-existent. But the data, although full of gaps, is mounting. Anne Rushon-Ford, a women's health researcher, tells me about how they started to realise there might be a problem in Canada. One of the central Toronto community health centres that is very close to Chinatown was seeing a lot of women coming into their clinic who had a particular cluster of conditions that are traditionally associated with chemical exposure, she explains. It turned out they were all nail salon workers. Several studies of air quality in nail salons have shown that they rarely exceed occupational exposure limits, but these limits are based on data that doesn't account for the impact of chronic long-term exposure. And this is particularly an issue when it comes to endocrine-disrupting chemicals, EDCs, because unlike most toxins, they can be harmful even at very low concentrations, and they are found in a wide range of plastics, cosmetics, and cleaners. EDCs mimic, and therefore can disrupt, reproductive hormones, triggering changes in how cells and organs function, with an impact on a diverse array of metabolic, growth, and reproductive processes in the body. The data on EDCs and their impact on women is limited, but what we do know is enough to give us pause and should certainly be enough to trigger a full-scale data collection program. EDCs are known to be linked to breast cancer, and several studies have found that cosmetologists are at a particularly elevated risk of Hodgkin's disease, multiple myeloma, and ovarian cancer. When occupational health researchers Jim and Margaret Brophy investigated the chemicals used in automotive plastics workplaces, where plastic parts for motorized vehicles are produced, we could not find any substances that they were using that weren't suspected to be either a mammary carcinogen and or an endocrine disruptor. If you're camping or around a campfire and somebody throws in a plastic bottle or a styrofoam cup, people run away, Brophy points out. The smell is enough to tell you it's toxic. Well, that's what these women are doing on a daily basis. They're working on moulding machines which heat up these plastic pellets, which are full of all kinds of EDCs. After 10 years of working in a job where she is exposed either to mammary carcinogens or an EDC, a woman's risk of developing breast cancer increases by 42%. But the Brophys found that after working for 10 years in the auto plastics industry, a woman's likelihood of developing breast cancer trebles. And if you were under the age of 50, so premenopausal breast cancer, it was a five-fold excess. Even a single year of working in this sector was estimated to increase the odds of developing breast cancer by 9%. The World Health Organization, the European Union, and the Endocrine Society have all issued major reports on the dangers of EDCs, with the Endocrine Society in particular linking their use to the significant increase in breast cancer rates in industrialized countries. And yet in many countries, regulation of EDCs is spotty at best. Phthalates, some of which have demonstrated endocrine-disrupting properties, are chemicals used to make plastics softer. They are found in a wide range of products, from children's toys to shower curtains. They are also used in nail polish, perfumes, and skin moisturizers, and can also be found in the outer coating in medicines and in the tubing used in medical devices. In Canada, they are explicitly regulated only in soft vinyl articles for children. Their use in the Canadian cosmetics industry is largely unregulated. In the EU, as of 2015, EDCs can't be produced unless authorized for a specific purpose, but they are allowed in products imported from abroad. In the US, there are no federal laws that require companies to list ingredients in their cleaning products. In the US, women do 70% of household cleaning and make up 89% of home and hotel cleaners, most of whom are ethnic minorities. And a recent report found that even supposedly green cleaning products contain EDCs. When Always menstrual pads were tested in 2014, they were found to include a number of chemicals, including styrene, chloroform, and acetone, that have been identified as either carcinogens or reproductive and developmental toxins. It's clear that we need more and better data about women's exposure to chemicals. We need data that is separated and analysed by sex and which includes reproductive status. And physical effects need to be measured for women themselves rather than being restricted to fetuses and newborns, as is all too often currently the case. We need researchers to understand that because of their unpaid workload, women often drop in and out of the workforce and work more than one job at a time, which can lead to, in Rory O'Neill's words, a cocktail of exposures. And that this means that research which tracks only a single current employment is likely to be sporting a significant gender data gap. There is no doubt that women are dying as a result of the gender data gap in occupational health research. And there is no doubt that we urgently need to start systematically collecting data on female bodies in the workplace. But there is a second strand to this story because, as the stickiness of the myth of meritocracy shows, closing the gender data gap is only step one. The next and crucial step is for governments and organisations to actually use that data to shape policy around it. This isn't happening. In Canada, even where sex disaggregated data on chemical exposure exists, the government continues to apply a mean all-person daily intake for many substances. In the UK, where around 2,000 women develop shift work-related breast cancer every year, breast cancer caused by shift work isn't on the state-prescribed disease list. Neither is asbestos related to ovarian cancer, even though it has the International Agency Research on Cancer's top cancer risk ranking and is the most common gynecological cancer in UK women. In fact, asbestos-related ovarian cancer cases aren't even tracked and counted by the UK's Health and Safety Executive. Part of the failure to see the risks in traditionally female-dominated industries is because often these jobs are an extension of what women do in the home, although at a larger and therefore more onerous scale. But the data gap when it comes to women in the workplace doesn't only arise in female-dominated industries. As we've seen, even when women worked in male-dominated industries, they were treated as confounding factors, and data on female workers went uncollected. The result is that even in industries with a good historical health and safety record, women are still being failed. In the US, where by 2007 there were nearly 1 million female farm operators, virtually all tools and equipment on the US market have been designed either for men or for some average user, whose size, weight, strength, etc. were heavily influenced by the average man. This has led to tools that are too heavy or long, hand tools that are not appropriately balanced, handles and grips that are not appropriately sized or placed, women's hands are on average 0.8 inches shorter than men's, and mechanized equipment that is too heavy or that is difficult to control, for example, pedals on tractors being placed too far from the seat. Little data exists on injuries to women in construction, but the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, NICOSH, points to a US study of union carpenters, which found that women had higher rates of sprains, strains, and nerve conditions of the wrist and forearm than men. Given the lack of data, it's hard to be sure exactly why this is, but it's a safe bet to put at least some, if not all, of the higher injury rates amongst women down to standard construction site equipment being designed around the male body. Wendy Davis, ex-director of the Women's Design Service in the UK, questions the standard size of a bag of cement. It's a comfortable weight for a man to lift, but it doesn't actually have to be that size, she points out. If they were a bit smaller, then women could lift them. Davis also takes issue with the standard brick size. I've got photographs of my adult daughter holding a brick. She can't get her hand round it. But her husband, Danny's hand, fits comfortably. Why does a brick have to be that size? It doesn't have to be that size. She also notes that the typical A1 architect's portfolio fits nicely under most men's arms, while most women's arms don't reach round it, and again has photos of her daughter and her husband to prove it. NICOSH similarly notes that standard hand tools like wrenches tend to be too large for women's hands to grip tightly. Women in the military are also affected by equipment designed around the male body. In the course of my research, I came across the impressively named Tactile Situation Awareness System, TSAS, a vest designed for Air Force pilots and fitted with 32 sensors that vibrate if the pilot needs to correct her position. Pilots can sometimes lose track of where they are in space and cannot tell if they are heading up or down. I say her because a review of tactile sensitivity and human tactile interfaces explained that the TSAS allows the pilot to always know his orientation with respect to the ground, The pronoun choice seems relevant, given that the review later casually mentions that vibration is detected best on hairy, bony skin and is more difficult to detect on soft, fleshy areas of the body. Women make up 20% of the US Air Force, and given women have breasts and don't tend to have particularly hairy chests, this sounds like it might be something of a problem for them. Failing to account for female bodies in the military doesn't just result in equipment that doesn't work for women. It can injure them too. Women in the British Army have been found to be up to 7 times more likely than men to suffer from musculoskeletal injuries, even if they have the same aerobic fitness and strength. They are 10 times more likely than men to suffer from hip and pelvic stress fractures. The higher rate of female pelvic stress fractures has been related to what I have christened the Henry Higgins effect. In the 1956 musical, My Fair Lady, phoneticist Henry Higgins is baffled when, after enduring months of his hectoring put-downs, his protégé-cum-victim Eliza Doolittle finally bites back. "Why can't a woman be more like a man?" he grumbles. It's a common complaint, and one for which the common solution is to fix the women. This is unsurprising in a world where what is male is seen as universal, and what is female is seen as atypical. And the leadership of the British Armed Forces have historically been a right bunch of Henry Higginses. Until 2013, when 3 RAF recruits, one of whom had been medically discharged after suffering 4 pelvic fractures, challenged the practice in court, women in the British Armed Forces were forced to match male stride length. The average man's stride is 9 to 10% longer than the average woman's. Since the Australian Army reduced the required stride length for women from 30 inches to 28 inches, pelvic stress fractures in women have fallen in number. And as an added bonus, not forcing women to march in time with men has not, as yet, led to the apocalypse. The heavy loads soldiers are required to carry may be aggravating the situation, as women's stride length decreases as loads increase, while men's stride length doesn't show significant change. This may go some way towards explaining US research, which found that a woman's risk of injury increases 5-fold if she is carrying more than 25% of her body weight. If packs were created for women's bodies, heavy loads might not be such a problem, but they haven't been. Women are more likely to find that rucksacks, which have been designed primarily based on the anthropometry of men, are unstable, that pistol belts fit poorly, and that pack straps are uncomfortable. Studies suggest that a well-padded hip belt allows a better transfer of the load to the hips, so women can use their stronger leg muscles to carry the load. While men's upper body strength is on average 50% higher than women's, the average gap in lower body strength is about half that. Instead, women compensate for packs built around typically male upper body strength by hyperextending their necks and bringing their shoulders further forward, leading to injury and a shorter stride length. It's not just packs that aren't created to accommodate women's bodies. It wasn't until 2011, 35 years after women were first admitted to US military academies, that the first uniforms were designed that accounted for women's hips and breasts. The uniforms also included repositioned knee pads to account for women's generally shorter legs, and, perhaps most exciting of all for a general audience, a redesigned crotch. These uniforms reportedly abandoned the universal zippered fly, instead being designed in such a way that women can pee without pulling down their trousers. But even though the existence of female bodies has finally been recognized by the US military, gaps remain. Boots designed to accommodate women's typically narrower feet and higher arches were not included in the uniform changes. According to the Washington Times, the US Army buys different boot styles for hot and cold weather, mountain and desert warfare, and the rain. Just not for the atypical sex. The peeing issue is a recurring one for women who have to spend any length of time outdoors. In the UK, all Coast Guards are issued with a set of one-piece overalls, which they are meant to put on underneath various other pieces of personal protective equipment, PPE, such as foul weather clothing, life jackets, and climbing harnesses. The double zip at the front of the overalls is great if you are a man. But, explained one woman in a 2017 Trades Union Congress TUC report, peeing becomes a major operation for women, as all the PPE must be stripped off, followed by the overalls themselves. As the type of incidents which we are called to regularly involve long searches, which can last for many hours, she explains, you can imagine the discomfort which female Coast Guards end up having to experience as a result. It has been suggested to management that the current overalls should be replaced with a two-piece garment, which would allow the trousers to be pulled down without having to remove the top section. And while management have acknowledged the advantage of this idea, nothing has so far been done to implement it. A female scientist studying climate change in Alaska was also plagued by overalls designed for the male body. The extreme cold means that overalls are the most sensible thing to wear, but, again, these come with a zip. Where there are indoor toilets, this would be inconvenient and require additional time spending taking off clothes from jacket downwards just for a pee. But when there is no indoor toilet, the problem is much more serious, as frostbite becomes a concern. The woman in question bought a rubber-funneled approximation of a penis to deal with the problem, and ended up peeing all over herself. Why can't a woman be more like a man? In the UK, employers are legally required to provide well-maintained PPE to workers free of charge. But most PPE is based on the sizes and characteristics of male populations from Europe and the US. The TUC found that employers often think that when it comes to female workers, all they need to do to comply with this legal requirement is to buy smaller sizes. A 2009 survey by the Women's Engineering Society found 74% of PPE was designed for men. A 2016 Prospect Union survey of women working in sectors ranging from the emergency services to construction via the energy industry found that just 29% wore PPE designed for women, while a 2016 TUC report found that less than 10% of women working in the energy sector and just 17% in construction currently wear PPE designed for women. One rail industry worker summed it up. Size small is A, a rarity, and B, men's small only. This unisex approach to PPE can lead to significant problems, cautions the TUC. Differences in chests, hips, and thighs can affect the way the straps fit on safety harnesses. The use of a standard US male face shape for dust, hazard, and eye masks means they don't fit most women, as well as a lot of black and minority ethnic men. Safety boots can also be a problem. One female police officer told the TUC about trying to get boots designed for female crime scene investigators. The PPE boots supplied are the same as those for males, she explains, and the females find them uncomfortable, too heavy, and causing pressure on the Achilles tendons. Our uniform stores refuse to address the matter. This isn't just about comfort. Ill-fitting PPE hampers women's work and can, ironically, sometimes itself be a safety hazard. Nikosh points out that loose clothing and gloves can get caught in machinery, while overly large boots can cause tripping. Of those surveyed for the 2016 Prospect Survey, 57% reported that their PPE sometimes or significantly hampered their work. Over 60% said the same in the Women's Engineering Society survey. One rail industry worker explained that the regular size 13 gloves she was issued were dangerous for climbing on-off locos, and she had complained to her manager. She doesn't reveal how long it took for management to order her gloves that fit, but another woman who had been issued with the standard size 13s told Prospect that it took her 2 years to convince her manager to order gloves in her size. A 2017 TUC report found that the problem with ill-fitting PPE was worst in the emergency services, where only 5% of women said that their PPE never hampered their work, with body armour, stab vests, high-vis vests and jackets all highlighted as unsuitable. This problem seems to be a global one. In 2018, a female police officer in Spain faced disciplinary action for wearing the women's bulletproof jacket she had bought for herself at a cost of €500 because the standard issue men's jacket did not fit her. Pilar Villacorta, women's secretary for the United Association of Civil Guards, explained to The Guardian that the overly large jackets leave female police officers doubly unprotected. They don't cover them properly, and they make it hard for female officers to reach their guns, handcuffs, and telescopic batons. When it comes to frontline workers, poorly fitting PPE can prove fatal. In 1997, a British female police officer was stabbed and killed while using a hydraulic ram to enter a flat. She had removed her body armour because it was too difficult to use the ram while wearing it. 2 years later, a female police officer revealed that she had to have breast reduction surgery because of the health effects of wearing her body armour. After this case was reported, another 700 officers in the same force came forward to complain about the standard issue protective vest. But although the complaints have been coming regularly over the past 20 years, little seems to have been done. British female police officers report being bruised by their kit belts. A number have had to have physiotherapy as a result of the way stab vests sit on their female body. Many complain there is no space for their breasts. This is not only uncomfortable, it also results in stab vests coming up too short, leaving women unprotected, which rather negates the whole point of wearing one. Chapter 6. Being Worth Less Than a Shoe. It was in 2008 that the big bisphenol A, BPA scare, got serious. Since the 1950s, this synthetic chemical had been used in the production of clear, durable plastics, and it was to be found in millions of consumer items from baby bottles to food cans to main water pipes. By 2008, 2.7 million tons of BPA was being produced globally every year, and it was so ubiquitous that it had been detected in the urine of 93% of Americans over the age of 6. And then a US federal health agency came out and said that this compound that we were all interacting with on a daily basis may cause cancer, chromosomal abnormalities, brain and behavioral abnormalities, and metabolic disorders. Crucially, it could cause all these medical problems at levels below the regulatory standard for exposure. Naturally, all hell broke loose. The story of BPA is in some ways a cautionary tale about what happens when we ignore female medical health data. We have known that BPA can mimic the female hormone estrogen since the mid-1930s, and since at least the 1970s, we have known that synthetic estrogen can be carcinogenic in women. In 1971, diethylstilbestrol, DES, another synthetic estrogen which had been prescribed to millions of pregnant women for 30 years, was banned following reports of rare vaginal cancers in young women exposed to DES while in their mother's wombs. But BPA carried on being used in hundreds of thousands of tons of consumer plastics. By the late 1980s, production of BPA in the United States soared to close to £1 billion per year as polycarbonates found new markets in compact discs, digital versatile discs, DVDs, water and baby bottles, and laboratory and hospital equipment. But the story of BPA is not just about gender. It's also about class. Or at least, it's about gendered class. Fearing a major consumer boycott, most baby bottle manufacturers voluntarily removed BPA from their products. And while the official US line on BPA is that it is not toxic, the EU and Canada are on their way to banning its use altogether. But the legislation that we have exclusively concerns consumers. No regulatory standard has ever been set for workplace exposure. It was ironic to me, says occupational health researcher Jim Brophy, that all this talk about the danger for pregnant women and women who had just given birth never extended to the women who were producing these bottles, those women whose exposures far exceeded anything you would have in the general environment. There was no talk about the pregnant worker who is on the machine that's producing this thing. This is a mistake, says Brophy. Worker health should be a public health priority, if only because workers are acting as a canary for society as a whole. If women's breast cancer rates in the plastic industry were documented and recognised, if we cared enough to look at what's going on in the health of workers that use these substances every day, it would have a tremendous effect on these substances being allowed to enter into the mainstream commerce. It would have a tremendous effect on public health. But we don't care enough. In Canada, where women's health researcher Anna Rochon-Ford is based, five women's health research centres that had been operating since the 1990s, including Ford's own, had their funding cut in 2013. It's a similar story in the UK, where public research budgets have been decimated, says Rory O'Neill. And so the far better resourced chemicals industry and its offshoots have successfully resisted regulation for years. They have fought government bans and restrictions. They have claimed that certain chemicals have been removed voluntarily when random testing has shown that they are still present. They have dismissed studies and other evidence of the negative health impacts of their products. Between 1997 and 2005, 115 studies were conducted on BPA in labs all over the world. 90% of those funded by government found that BPA had effects at exposures at or below the reference dose. Of the 11 studies funded by industry, none reported any effects. The result is that workplaces remain unsafe. Brophy tells me that the ventilation he found in most auto plastics factories was limited to fans in the ceiling, so the fumes literally pass the breathing zone and head to the roof, and in the summertime, when it's really hot in there and the fumes become visible, they will open the doors. It's the same story in Canadian nail salons, says Rochon-Ford. It's a wild west here. Anyone can open a nail salon. It's only recently that you even needed a license. But even this is pretty lax. There are no ventilation requirements, there are no training requirements, there is no legislation around wearing gloves and masks, and there is nobody following up on the requirements that do exist, unless someone makes a complaint. But here we run into another difficulty. Who is going to make a complaint? Certainly not the women themselves. Women working in nail salons, in auto plastics factories, in a vast range of hazardous workplaces are some of the most vulnerable, powerless workers you can find. They are poor, working class, often immigrants who can't afford to put their immigration status at risk, and this makes them ripe for exploitation. Auto plastics factories tend not to be part of the big car companies like Ford. They are usually arm's-length suppliers, who tend to be non-unionised and tend to be able to get away with more employment standard violations, Roshan Ford tells me. It doesn't help that Windsor, Ontario, the heart of the auto industry in Canada, has one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. The result is that workers know that if they demand better protections, the response will be, fine, you're out of here. There's 10 women outside the door who want your job. We've heard factory workers tell us this in the exact same words, says Roshan Ford. If this sounds illegal, well, it may be. Over the past 100 years or so, a framework of employee rights has been established. They vary from country to country, but they tend to include a right to paid sick and maternity leave, a right to a set number of hours, and protection from unfair and or sudden dismissal. But these rights only apply if you are an employee, and increasingly, many workers are not. In many nail salons, technicians are technically independent contractors. This makes life much easier for the employers. The inherent risk of running a company based on consumer demand is passed on to workers who have no guaranteed hours and no job security. Not enough customers today? Don't come in and don't get paid. Minor accident? You're out of here and forget about redundancy pay. In 2015, the New York Times reported the story of manicurist King Lin, 47, who splashed some nail polish remover on a customer's patent Prada sandals. When the woman demanded compensation, the $270 her boss pressed into the woman's hand came out of the manicurist's pay, and Lin was fired. "I am worth less than a shoe," she said. Lin's story appeared in a New York Times investigation of nail salons, which revealed all manner of humiliation suffered by workers, including constant video monitoring by owners, verbal and even physical abuse. Lawsuits filed in New York courts include allegations of 66-hour weeks at $1.50 an hour and no pay at all on slow days in a salon that charged manicurists for drinking the water. Following the publication of the New York Times investigation, a licensing system was introduced in New York. Workers there must be paid at least the minimum wage, and nail salons must display a Bill of Rights in multiple languages. But workers elsewhere in the US and elsewhere in the world are less lucky. In the UK, regulation and licensing of nail bars is largely voluntary, which in practice means largely non-existent. A 2017 report described the predominantly female Vietnamese workforce as victims of modern slavery. Nail salons are the tip of an extremely poorly regulated iceberg when it comes to employers exploiting loopholes in employment law. Zero-hour contracts, short-term contracts, employment through an agency, these have all been enticingly rebranded the gig economy by Silicon Valley, as if they are of benefit to workers. But the gig economy is in fact often no more than a way for employers to get around basic employee rights. Casual contracts create a vicious cycle. The rights are weaker to begin with, which makes workers reticent to fight for the ones they do still have. And so those get bent too. In the UK, which has seen one of the fastest growths in precarious work in the EU, TUC research uncovered a work environment that was rife with employers using casual contracts to illegally undermine workers' rights. Naturally, the impact of what the International Trade Union Confederation, ITUC, has termed the startling growth of precarious work has barely been gender analysed. The ITUC reports that its feminised impact is poorly reflected in official statistics and government policies because the standard indicators and data used to measure developments on labour markets are not gender sensitive and, as ever, data is not sex disaggregated, making it sometimes difficult to measure the overall numbers of women. There are, as a result, no global figures related to the number of women in precarious work. But the regional and sector-specific studies that do exist suggest an over-representation of women in precarious jobs. In the UK, the trade union Unison found that by 2014, women made up almost two-thirds of low-paid workers, and many were working multiple jobs on precarious contracts to make up lost hours. According to a recent Fawcett Society report, 1 in 8 British women is employed on a zero-hours contract. In London, that figure is nearly 1 in 3. And although we often think of precarious work as being relegated to the less prestigious end of the job market, it increasingly appears in all sectors and at all levels. According to the UK's University and College Union, tertiary education, usually considered an elite profession, is the second highest user of casual labour. The UCU's data is not sex disaggregated, but according to the UK's Higher Education Statistics Agency, women are more likely than men to be on shorter, fixed-term contracts, and statistics from Germany and Europe show the same. More broadly, across the EU, most of the increase in women's employment over the past decade has been through part-time and precarious work. In Australia, 30% of women are in casual employment, compared to 22% of men, while in Japan, women make up two-thirds of non-regular workers. A Harvard study on the rise of alternative work in America between 2005 and 2015 found that the percentage of women in such work more than doubled, meaning that women are now more likely than men to be employed in an alternative work arrangement. This is a problem because while precarious work isn't ideal for any worker, it can have a particularly severe impact on women. For a start, it is possible that it is exacerbating the gender pay gap. In the UK, there is a 34% hourly pay penalty for workers on 0 hours contracts, a 39% hourly pay penalty for workers on casual contracts, and a 20% pay penalty for agency workers, which are on the increase as public services continue to be outsourced. But no one seems interested in finding out how this might be affecting women. An analysis of pay policy in Europe criticises the outsourcing trend for seeming to have been implemented with little or no reference to their gender effects, and existing data suggests that those gender effects are plentiful. There is, to begin with, limited scope for collective bargaining in agency jobs. This is a problem for all workers, but can be especially problematic for women because evidence suggests that collective bargaining, as opposed to individual salary negotiation, could be particularly important for women. Those pesky modesty norms again. As a result, an increase in jobs like agency work that don't allow for collective bargaining might be detrimental to attempts to close the gender pay gap. But the negative impact of precarious work on women isn't just about unintended side effects. It's also about the weaker rights that are intrinsic to the gig economy. In the UK, a female employee is only entitled to maternity leave if she is actually an employee. If she's a worker, that is, someone on a short-term or zero-hours contract, she isn't entitled to any leave at all, meaning she would have to quit her job and reapply after she's given birth. A female worker is also only entitled to statutory maternity pay if she has worked for 26 weeks in the last 66 and if her average wage is at least £116 per week. And this is where the problems can kick in. Not being entitled to return to her job meant that Holly, a research associate at a UK university, ended up dropping two pay grades after giving birth. Maria, also a university researcher, had her hours suddenly and mysteriously cut in half 6 weeks before she was due to give birth. Conveniently for her employer, the amount of maternity pay she was owed dropped correspondingly. The same thing happened to Rachel, who works in a pub restaurant. Her hours suddenly dropped when she told her employer she was pregnant. She now might not even qualify for statutory maternity pay at all. After giving birth, Maria ended up on a new university contract for just under 3 hours a week, the only hours on offer. She can and does work extra hours to cover staff absences, but the extra hours are often at short notice. And here we run into the second major problem that disproportionately impacts on female workers: unpredictable last-minute scheduling. As we've seen, women still do the vast majority of the world's unpaid care work, and particularly when it comes to childcare, this makes irregular hours extremely difficult. This is partly because, in another case of having the data but failing to use it, British childcare provision has not caught up with the reality of how women are working. We know that 75% of UK families on low to middle incomes now work outside standard hours, but most formal childcare is still only available between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. It must be booked and paid for well in advance, which is difficult if you don't know when you're going to need it. This problem is particularly acute for single parents, 90% of whom in the UK are women, a group that has seen a 27% increase in temporary work. And given Britain has one of the highest childcare costs in Europe, it's also an expensive one. The scheduling issue is being made worse by gender-insensitive algorithms. A growing number of companies use just-in-time scheduling software, which use sales patterns and other data to predict how many workers will be needed at any one time. They also respond to real-time sales analysis, telling managers to send workers home when consumer demand is slow. It's like magic, the vice president for business development at Kronos, which supplies the software for a number of US chains, told the New York Times. It probably does feel like magic for the companies that use this software to boost profits by shifting the risks of doing business onto their workers. It probably also feels pretty great for the increasing number of managers who are compensated on the efficiency of their staffing. It feels less great, however, for the workers themselves, particularly those with caring responsibilities. Jeanette Navarro, a barista at Starbucks in San Diego, showed the New York Times her upcoming algorithm-produced schedule. It involved working until 11 p.m. on the Friday, reporting again at 4 a.m. on Saturday, and then starting again at 5 a.m. on Sunday. She rarely learned her schedule more than 3 days in advance, causing havoc for her childcare arrangements and forcing her to put her associate degree in business on hold. It's another example of how the introduction of big data into a world full of gender data gaps can magnify and accelerate already existing discriminations, whether its designers didn't know or didn't care about the data on women's unpaid caring responsibilities. The software has clearly been designed without reference to them. A Starbucks spokesperson told the New York Times that Navarro's experience was an anomaly and that the company provided at least a week's notice of work hours as well as stable schedules for employees who want them. But when journalists spoke to current and former workers at 17 Starbucks outlets around the country, only two said they received a week's notice of their hours. Some got as little as 1 day. And although a few cities have introduced laws regulating the minimum advance notice of a shift an employer can give their workers, there is no nationwide regulation in America, nor is there in many other countries, including in the UK. It is not good enough. The work that mainly women do, mainly unpaid, alongside their paid employment, is not an optional extra. This is work that society needs to get done. And getting it done is entirely incompatible with just-in-time scheduling designed entirely without reference to it. Which leaves us with two options. Either states provide free, publicly funded alternatives to women's unpaid work, or they put an end to just-in-time scheduling. A woman doesn't need to be in precarious employment to have her rights violated. Women on irregular or precarious employment contracts have been found to be more at risk of sexual harassment, perhaps because they are less likely to take action against a colleague or employer who is harassing them. But as the Me Too movement washes over social media, it is becoming increasingly hard to escape the reality that it is a rare industry in which sexual harassment isn't a problem. As ever, there is a data gap. The TUC warns of a paucity of up-to-date quantitative data on sexual harassment in the workplace, a problem that seems to exist worldwide, with official statistics extremely hard to come by. The UN estimates are all we have, that up to 50% of women in EU countries have been sexually harassed at work. The figure in China is thought to be as high as 80%. In Australia, a study found that 60% of female nurses had been sexually harassed. The extent of the problem varies from industry to industry. Workplaces that are either male-dominated or have a male-dominated leadership are often the worst for sexual harassment. A 2016 study by the TUC found that 69% of women in manufacturing and 67% of women in hospitality and leisure reported experiencing some form of sexual harassment compared to an average of 52%. A 2011 US study similarly found that the construction industry had the highest rates of sexual harassment, followed by transportation and utilities. One survey of senior-level women working in Silicon Valley found that 90% of women had witnessed sexist behavior, 87% had been on the receiving end of demeaning comments by male colleagues, and 60% had received unwanted sexual advances. Of that 60%, more than half had been propositioned more than once, and 65% had been propositioned by a superior. One in three women surveyed had felt afraid for her personal safety. Some of the worst experiences of harassment come from women whose work brings them into close contact with the general public. In these instances, harassment all too often seems to spill over into violence. He picked her up, threw her across the room, pounded her face, and there was blood everywhere. This is when he grabbed me and hit me with the glass. I slumped to the ground and he was still pounding me. I fought him all the way down the hall. He put my head through the wall. There was blood on the walls from my elbows, my face. If this doesn't sound like just another day in the office for you, be grateful that you're not a health worker. Research has found that nurses are subjected to more acts of violence than police officers or prison guards. In Ontario in 2014, the number of workplace injuries that required time off work from the healthcare sector greatly outnumbered those in other sectors surveyed. A recent US study similarly found that healthcare workers required time off due to violence 4 times more often than other types of injury. Following the research he conducted with fellow occupational health researcher Margaret Brophy, Jim Brophy concluded that the Canadian health sector was one of the most toxic work environments that we had ever seen. From their 2017 paper on the violence faced by Canadian healthcare workers, the Brophys held focus groups where people would regularly say, "Every day I go into work and I'm confronted with this." When the Brophys pulled them up on this claim, surely every day was hyperbole, they meant often. And they would correct us. "No, we mean every day. It's become part of the job." One worker recalled the time a patient got a chair above his head, noting that the nursing station has been smashed 2 or 3 times. Other patients used bedpans, dishes, even loose building materials as weapons against nurses. But despite its prevalence, workplace violence in healthcare is an underreported, ubiquitous, and persistent problem that has been tolerated and largely ignored. This is partly because the studies simply haven't been done. According to the Brophys research, prior to 2000, violence against healthcare workers was barely on the agenda. When in February 2017 they searched Medline for workplace violence against nurses, they found 155 international articles, 149 of which were published from 2000 to the time of the search. But the global data gap when it comes to the sexual harassment and violence women face in the workplace is not just down to a failure to research the issue. It's also down to the vast majority of women not reporting. And this in turn is partly down to organisations not putting in place adequate procedures for dealing with the issue. Women don't report because they fear reprisals and because they fear nothing will be done, both of which are reasonable expectations in many industries. "We scream," one nurse told the Brophys. "The best we can do is scream." The inadequacy of procedures to deal with the kind of harassment that female workers face is itself likely also a result of a data gap. Leadership in all sectors is male-dominated, and the reality is that men do not face this kind of aggression in the way women do. And so, rather like the Google leadership not thinking to put in pregnancy parking, many organisations don't think to put in procedures to deal adequately with sexual harassment and violence. It's another example of how much a diversity of experience at the top matters for everyone, and how much it matters if we are serious about closing the data gap. The Brophys warn that gender is also typically absent in analyses of health sector violence. This is unfortunate. According to the International Council of Nurses, nurses are the healthcare workers most at risk, and the vast majority of nurses are women. The absence of gender analysis also means that most of the research doesn't factor in the chronic underreporting of sexual violence. The Brophys found that only 12% of the workers in their study reported it. "We don't report sexual violence because it happens so frequently," explained one woman who had been grabbed many times. But an awareness that the official data is believed to grossly underestimate the incidents due to widespread underreporting just isn't in the literature, Brophy tells me. This metadata gap goes unremarked. The violence nurses face at work is not helped by traditional hospital design. "The long hallways isolate workers," explains Brophy, "scattering them far away from each other." "Those hallways are terrible," one worker told Brophy. "You work way over there, and you can't communicate. I would prefer a full roundabout circle." This would be an improvement, Brophy points out, because it would enable staff to support each other better. If the area was rounded, workers wouldn't be off on one end. If there was two people, one would hear something going on. Most nursing stations don't have protective shatterproof barriers or exits behind the desk, leaving nurses vulnerable to attack. Another worker told Brophy about the time her co-worker was sexually assaulted by a patient. The inspector recommended that they put glass up. The hospital fought them on it. They said it stigmatizes the patients. Both the workers Brophy interviewed and the US Occupational Health and Safety Administration have highlighted several design features of traditional hospitals: unsecured access/egress, insufficient heating or cooling, irritating noise levels, unsecured items that compound the safety issue, all of which could be addressed without stigmatizing anyone. Governments could also reverse policies that result in routine understaffing, an issue that Brophy heard in every group in every location, with workers identifying wait times as a trigger for violent behaviour directed towards staff. If you don't have the staff to immediately address their issue, if they're kept waiting, they're more likely to escalate in their behaviour, explained one worker. Redesigning hospital layouts and increasing staffing levels, of course, don't come cheap. But there's likely a cost argument that could be made given the amount of time off from injuries and stress workers are taking. Unfortunately, this data is not being adequately collected, Brophy tells me. But, he continues, I can tell you there's not a doubt in my mind that that is a very high-stress work environment and that the demand on people and the limited amount of control they have is the perfect scenario for job burnout. And then there's the cost implications of training people who then leave the profession, which came up repeatedly in the focus groups the Brophy's conducted. We had nurses with 25 to 30 years seniority saying, I'm going to become a cleaner, or I'm going to work in the kitchen because I can't deal with it anymore. I can't handle the lack of support and the danger and the risk and coming in every day and facing these things and then being negated and unsupported. But even without taking this more long-term view, there are plenty of lower-cost options, some of them dazzlingly simple. Consistently charting and flagging patient violence, making reporting procedures less onerous, and having supervisors actually read the reports. Ensuring alarms make different noises depending on their purpose. In one instance, the patient call bell, bathroom assist bell, code blue for respiratory or cardiac arrest, and staff emergency alarms all made the same sound in the nurse's station. Fans of British 1970s TV will recognise this problem with alarms as the plot of an actual Fawlty Towers episode. Signs making it clear what behaviour is and isn't acceptable would also be inexpensive. I notice at the hospital coffee shop they have a sign that says they won't tolerate any type of verbal abuse, one woman told the Brophy's. But there's no signs on our units that say that. There is a poster about if you're widowed and lonely. Here's a singles website. But you won't put up a violence sign for us? Perhaps most staggeringly simple, participants in the Brophy's research suggested that they be permitted to have their last names removed from their name tags, at their employer's expense, as a safety measure. This would avoid incidents such as when a visitor to the hospital told a female worker, "Very nice to see you," her name. "And you know, you shouldn't have your last name on your badge because I can just look you up and find out who you are and where you live." Women have always worked. They have worked unpaid, underpaid, underappreciated and invisibly. But they have always worked. But the modern workplace does not work for women. From its location, to its hours, to its regulatory standards, it has been designed around the lives of men, and it is no longer fit for purpose. The world of work needs a wholesale redesign of its regulations, of its equipment, of its culture, and this redesign must be led by data on female bodies and female lives. We have to start recognising that the work women do is not an added extra, a bonus that we could do without. Women's work, paid and unpaid, is the backbone of our society and our economy. It's about time we started valuing it. Part 3. Design. Chapter 7. The Plough Hypothesis. It was the Danish economist Esther Boserup who first came up with the Plough Hypothesis, that societies that had historically used the plough would be less gender equal than those that hadn't. The theory is based on the relative female friendliness of shifting agriculture, which is done using handheld tools like hoes or digging sticks, versus plough agriculture, usually driven by a powerful animal like a horse or an ox, the idea being that the former is more accessible to women. This sex difference in accessibility is partly because of the differences between male and female bodies. Ploughing requires significant upper body strength, grip strength, and bursts of power which are needed to either pull the plough or control the animal that pulls it, and this privileges male bodies. Upper body mass is approximately 75% greater in men because women's lean body mass tends to be less concentrated in their upper body, and as a result, men's upper body strength is on average between 40 to 60% higher than women's, compared to lower body strength, which is on average only 25% higher in men. Women also have an average of 41% lower grip strength than men, and this is not a sex difference that changes with age. The typical 70-year-old man has a stronger hand grip than the average 25-year-old woman. It's also not a sex difference that can be significantly trained away. A study which compared highly trained female athletes to men who were untrained or not specifically trained found that their grip strength rarely surpassed the 50th percentile of male subjects. Overall, 90% of the women, this time including untrained women, in the study had a weaker grip than 95% of their male counterparts. But the disparity in the relative female friendliness of plough versus shifting agriculture is also a result of gendered social roles. Hoeing can be easily started and stopped, meaning that it can be combined with childcare. The same cannot be said for a heavy tool drawn by a powerful animal. Hoeing is also labour-intensive, whereas ploughing is capital-intensive, and women are more likely to have access to time rather than money as a resource. As a result, argued Boserup, where the plough was used, men dominated agriculture, and this resulted in unequal societies in which men had the power and the privilege. According to a 2011 paper, Boserup's hypothesis holds up to scrutiny. Researchers found that descendants of societies that traditionally practiced plough agriculture held more sexist views even if they emigrated to other countries. The paper also found that sexist beliefs correlated with the kind of geoclimatic conditions that would favour plough agriculture over shifting agriculture. This suggested that it was the climate rather than pre-existing sexism that dictated the adoption of the plough, which in turn drove the adoption of sexist views. The plough theory has its detractors. A 2014 analysis of farming in Ethiopia points out that while farming is strongly identified with men in that country, the farmer is male in virtually all Amharic folklore, and ploughing in particular is exclusively male, the upper body strength argument doesn't hold there because they use a lighter plough. Although this, of course, doesn't deal with the capital investment or childcare issues. This analysis also cites a 1979 paper which disputes the theory on the basis that even where the plough never was introduced, among South Kushites in particular, still men are the cultivators. Are they, though? It's hard to say because the data on who exactly is doing the farming is, yes, you've guessed it, full of gaps. You'll find no end of reports, articles and briefing papers that include some variation on the claim that women are responsible for 60 to 80% of the agricultural labour supplied on the continent of Africa, but little in the way of evidence. This statistic has been traced back to a 1972 United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, and it's not that it is necessarily wrong, it's just that we can't prove it one way or the other because we lack the data. This is partly because given men and women often farm together, it is difficult to accurately determine how much of the labour of either sex goes into producing an end food product. In a United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, paper, economist Cheryl Doss points out that it also depends on how we define and value food. By caloric value, where staple crops would come out on top, or by monetary value, where coffee might win. Given women tend to be more heavily involved in the production of staple crops, comparing calorific value might indicate a significantly higher share being produced by women. Might is doing a lot of work there, though, because national surveys often don't report on whether farmers are men or women. Even where data is sex disaggregated, careless survey design can lead to an underreporting of female labour. If women are asked if they do domestic duties or work, as if they are mutually exclusive, or as if domestic work is not work, they tend to just select domestic duties because that describes the majority of what they do. This gap is then compounded by the tendency to emphasize income-generating activities, the result being that they often underestimate, often female-dominated, subsistence production. The censuses also tend to define agriculture as fieldwork, which leads to an undercounting of the women's work, such as rearing small livestock, kitchen gardening, and post-harvest processing. It's a fairly clear example of male bias leading to a substantial gender data gap. A similar problem arises with the division of work by researchers into primary and secondary activities. For a start, secondary activities are not always collected by surveys. Even when they aren't always counted in labour force figures, and this is a male bias that makes women's paid work invisible. Women will often list their paid work as their secondary activity simply because their unpaid work takes up so much time, but that doesn't mean that they aren't spending a substantial proportion of their day on paid work. The result is that labour force statistics often sport a substantial gender data gap. This male bias is present in the data DOS uses to check the 60 to 80% statistics. FOSS concludes that women make up less than half of the global agricultural labour force. But in the FAO data she uses, an individual is reported as being in the agricultural labour force if he or she reports that agriculture is his or her main economic activity, which, as we've seen, is to exclude a substantial chunk of women's paid labour. To be fair to DOS, she does acknowledge the issues associated with this approach, critiquing the absurdly low 16% reported share of the agricultural labour force for women in Latin America. Rural women in Latin America, notes DOS, are likely to reply that their home is their primary responsibility, even if they are heavily engaged in agriculture. But even if we were to address all these gendered data gaps in calculating female agricultural labour, we still wouldn't know exactly how much of the food on your table is produced by women. And this is because female input doesn't equal male output. Women on the whole are less productive in agriculture than men. This doesn't mean that they don't work as hard. It means that for the work that they do, they produce less, because agriculture, from tools to scientific research to development initiatives, has been designed around the needs of men. In fact, writes Doss, given women's various constraints, lack of access to land, credit, and new technologies, as well as their unpaid work responsibilities, it would be surprising if they were able to produce over half of food crops. The FAO estimates that if women had the same access to productive resources as men, yields on their farms could increase by up to 30%. But they don't. In an echo of the introduction of the plough, some modern labour-saving devices might more precisely be labelled male labour-saving devices. A 2014 study in Syria, for example, found while the introduction of mechanisation in farming did reduce demand for male labour, freeing men up to pursue better-paying opportunities outside of agriculture, it actually increased demand for women's labour-intensive tasks such as transplanting, weeding, harvesting, and processing. Conversely, when some agricultural tasks were mechanised in Turkey, women's participation in the agricultural labour force decreased because of men's appropriation of machinery, and because women were reluctant to adopt it. This was in part due to lack of education and sociocultural norms, but also because the machinery was not designed for use by women. It's not just physical tools that can benefit men at the expense of women. Take what are called extension services, educational programs designed to teach farmers science-based practice so they can be more productive. Historically, extension services have not been female-friendly. According to a 1988-9 FAO survey, limited to those countries that actually had sex-disaggregated data, only 5% of all extension services were directed towards women. And while things have slightly improved since then, there are still plenty of contemporary examples of development initiatives that forget to include women, and therefore at best don't help, and at worst actively disadvantage them. A 2015 analysis by Data2X, a UN-backed organisation set up by Hillary Clinton that is lobbying to close the global gender data gap, found that many interventions simply don't reach women, in part because women are already overworked and don't have time to spare for educational initiatives, no matter how beneficial they may end up being. Development planners also have to factor in women's lack of mobility, in part because of their care responsibilities, but also because they are less likely to have access to transport and often face barriers to travelling alone. Then there's the language and literacy barrier. Many programs are conducted in the national language, which women are less likely than men to have been taught. Due to the low global levels of female education, women are also less likely to be able to read, so written materials don't help either. These are all fairly basic concerns and shouldn't be hard to account for, but there is plenty of evidence that they continue to be ignored. Many development initiatives exclude women by requiring a minimum land size, or that the person who attends the training is the head of a farming household, or the owner of the land that is farmed. Others exclude women by focusing solely on farms that have enough money to be able to purchase technology, for example. These conditions are all biased towards male farmers, because women dominate the ranks of poor farmers, they dominate the ranks of small-scale farmers, and they are overwhelmingly unlikely to own the land that they farm. In order to design interventions that actually help women, first we need the data. But it sometimes feels like we're not even trying to collect it. A 2012 Gates Foundation document tells the story of an unnamed organisation that aimed to breed and distribute improved varieties of staple crops. But improved is in the eye of the farmer, and when this organisation did its field testing, it spoke almost exclusively to men. Male farmers said that yield was the most important trait, and so that was the crop that the organisation bred. And then it was surprised when households didn't adopt it. The decision to talk only to men was bizarre. For all the gaps in our data, we can at least say that women do a fair amount of farming. 79% of economically active women in the least developed countries and 48% of economically active women in the world report agriculture as their primary economic activity. And the female farmers in this area didn't see yields as the most important thing. They cared about other factors, like how much land preparation and weeding these crops required, because these are female jobs. And they cared about how long, ultimately, the crops would take to cook, another female job. The new high-yield varieties increased the time the women had to spend on these other tasks, and so, unsurprisingly, they did not adopt these crops. The only thing that development planners need to do to avoid such pitfalls is to speak to some women, but they seem bafflingly resistant to this idea. And if you think the decision to design a new staple crop without talking to women is bad, wait until you hear about the history of clean stoves in the developing world. Humans, by which I mean mainly women, have been cooking with three stone fires since the Neolithic era. These are exactly what they sound like. three stones on the ground on which to balance a pot, with fuel, wood or whatever else you can gather that will burn, placed in the middle. In South Asia, 75% of families are still using biomass fuels, wood and other organic matter, for energy. In Bangladesh, the figure is as high as 90%. In sub-Saharan Africa, biomass fuels are the primary source of energy used for cooking for 753 million people. That's 80% of the population. The trouble with traditional stoves is that they give off extremely toxic fumes. A woman cooking on a traditional stove in an unventilated room is exposed to the equivalent of more than 100 cigarettes a day. According to a 2016 paper, in countries from Peru to Nigeria, toxic fumes from stoves are between 20 and 100 times above World Health Organization guideline limits, and globally they cause three times more deaths, 2.9 million, every year than malaria. This is all made worse by the inefficiency of traditional stoves. Women who cook on them are exposed to these fumes for 3 to 7 hours a day, meaning that worldwide indoor air pollution is the single largest environmental risk factor for female mortality and the leading killer of children under the age of 5. Indoor air pollution is also the 8th leading contributor to the overall global disease burden, causing respiratory and cardiovascular damage, as well as increased susceptibility to infectious illnesses such as tuberculosis and lung cancer. However, as is so often the case with health problems that mainly affect women, these adverse health effects have not been studied in an integrated and scientifically rigorous manner. Development agencies have been trying to introduce clean stoves since the 1950s, with varying levels of success. The initial impetus was to address deforestation rather than to ease women's unpaid labour or to address the health implications of traditional stove fumes. When it transpired that the environmental disaster was in fact driven by clearing land for agriculture rather than by women's collection of fuel, most of the development industry simply dropped their clean stove distribution initiatives. Emma Crewe, an anthropologist at SOAS University of London, explains that clean stove initiatives were deemed to be a failure as a solution to the energy crisis and not relevant to any other development area. But clean stoves are back on the agenda, and in September 2010, Hillary Clinton announced the formation of the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves, which calls for 100 million additional homes to adopt clean and efficient stoves and fuels by 2020. This is a laudable aim, but if it is to be implemented, and if women are actually to use the stoves, a lot of work still remains to be done, not least on data collection. A 2014 UN publication notes that, relative to data on water and sanitation, country data on access to efficient cook stoves is sparse, with national energy policies and poverty reduction strategy papers tending to focus on electrification instead. According to a 2005 World Bank report, when it comes to collecting data on people's access to energy, governments also tend to measure things like the number of new grid connections rather than the socio-economic impact of development projects. They also don't generally collect data on what user needs actually are, for example, drinking water pumping, food processing, fuel collection, before starting on their development projects. And the result of this dearth of data is that, to date, clean cook stoves have nearly all been rejected by users. In the 1990s, Emma Crewe was informed by stove technicians that low adoption was because users came from a conservative culture. They needed educating in proper stove usage. Women are still being blamed in the 21st century. A 2013 Wash Plus and USAID-funded report on user experiences of 5 stoves in Bangladesh repeatedly acknowledged that all 5 stoves increased cooking time and required more attending. This prevented women from multitasking as they would with a traditional stove and forced them to change the way they cooked, again increasing their workload. Nevertheless, the main and repeated recommendation of the report was to fix the women rather than the stoves. The women needed to be educated on how great the improved stoves were, rather than stove designers needing to be educated on how not to increase women's already 15-hour average working day. Despite what academics, NGOs, and expatriate technicians seem to think, the problem is not the women. It is the stoves. Developers have consistently prioritized technical parameters such as fuel efficiency over the needs of the stove user, frequently leading users to reject them, explains Crewe. And although the low adoption rate is a problem going back decades, development agencies have yet to crack the problem for the very simple reason that they still haven't got the hang of consulting women and then designing a product rather than enforcing a centralized design on them from above. One Indian program failed because while the new stove worked well in the lab, it required more maintenance than traditional stoves. Maintenance the designers had simply assumed the household would take care of. But structural repairs in Orissa are traditionally the responsibility of men who didn't see fixing the new stoves as a priority because their wives could still prepare meals using the traditional stoves. So the women went back to using the toxic, fume-producing traditional stoves while the new stoves gathered dust in corners. The issue of gendered priorities also affects household spending, and therefore if a household will adopt a stove at all. Despite hundreds of attempts to introduce a variety of clean stoves in Bangladesh since the early 1980s, over 98% of the rural population continue to cook with traditional biomass-burning stoves. A 2010 study which set out to understand why found that women seemed to exhibit a stronger preference than men for any improved stove, in particular for the health-saving chimney stoves, and were more likely to order stoves when asked without their husbands present. But when the team returned to deliver the stoves 4 months later, the gender gap had disappeared. Women's preferences had fallen back into line with their husbands. That women's failure to adopt clean stoves may simply result from a lack of purchasing authority is backed up by a 2016 report which found that female-headed households are more likely to adopt cleaner cooking solutions than male-headed households. Meanwhile, a 2012 Yale study found that 94% of respondents believed that indoor smoke from the traditional stoves is harmful, but opted for traditional cookstove technology so they could afford basic needs. Although this didn't prevent the university from headlining a press release on the study, despite efforts for change, Bangladeshi women prefer to use pollution-causing cookstoves, as if the women were perverse rather than lacking in purchasing authority. Perhaps silly women obstreperously choosing air pollution for no good reason made for a better headline than endemic poverty. This decades-long failure to design either stoves or implementation plans that account for women's needs is a health disaster that is set to get worse. As climate change makes high-quality fuel increasingly scarce because of soil erosion and desertification, women are forced to use leaves, straw, and dung, which give off fumes that are even more toxic. And this is a travesty because there is no doubt that clean stoves would significantly improve women's lives. A 2011 Yemen study found that women who lacked access to water and gas stoves spent 24% of their time engaged in paid work. This rose to around 52% for women who did have access. A 2016 report into stove use in India found that when women did adopt clean stoves, for example, the cheap and portable Anagi 2, which has been found to substantially decrease cooking time, they had more time for social and family activities and community meetings. Households with clean stoves also reported sending their children to school more often. There is some cause for hope. In November 2015, researchers in India reported that they had conducted a successful field study using an inexpensive $1 device that may be simply placed in existing 3-stone hearths. This simple device cut wood use and smoke to levels comparable to those achieved by the more expensive high-efficiency cookstoves. This breakthrough came about as a result of filling a decades-long data gap. Noting that the 2 decades of government attempts to implement high-efficiency cookstoves, HECs, in rural India had been largely unsuccessful, the researchers decided to investigate why. And by speaking to women, they found out. HECs were unable to accept large pieces of wood without having them split lengthwise, an issue also uncovered in the 2013 study of 5 clean stoves mentioned earlier. These researchers understood that everything to do with cooking, including fuel, was the domain of women, and that since splitting wood was very difficult for the women to do, it was perfectly rational for women to abandon these HECs, since their traditional chullas, mud and brick stoves, have no such size limitation. Based on their findings, they set about fixing the stove technology to fit the women. Realizing that a single HEC stove cannot possibly replace all of these traditional stoves, the researchers concluded that significant fuel wood reductions can only be achieved with locally customizable solutions in different parts of the world. The result of their data-led design was the Mewar Angifi, MA, a simple metal device that was engineered to be placed in the traditional chulla in order to provide the same airflow mechanism in the traditional chulla as occurs in the HEC stoves. To keep costs down, another regular concern of stove users, they constructed the device from metal washer industry scrap metal that they found in a local market at 1/4 the cost of solid metal sheets. And because of the simple bent plate design of the MA, it is easily customized to individual chulla units. Since then, studies in Kenya and Ghana with the same device have found similarly positive results, showing what can be achieved when designers start from the basis of closing the gender data gap. Chapter 8. One Size Fits Men. In 1998, a pianist called Christopher Donison wrote that one can divide the world into roughly two constituencies, those with larger hands and those with smaller hands. Donison was writing as a male pianist who, due to his smaller-than-average hands, had struggled for years with traditional keyboards, but he could equally have been writing as a woman. There is plenty of data showing that women have, on average, smaller hands than men, and yet we continue to design equipment around the average male hand as if one-size-fits-men is the same as one-size-fits-all. This one-size-fits-men approach to supposedly gender-neutral products is disadvantaging women. The average female hand span is between 7 and 8 inches, which makes the standard 48-inch keyboard something of a challenge. Octaves on a standard keyboard are 7.4 inches wide, and one study found that this keyboard disadvantages 87% of adult female pianists. Meanwhile, a 2015 study which compared the hand span of 473 adult pianists to their level of acclaim found that all 12 of the pianists considered to be of international renown had spans of 8.8 inches or above. Of the two women who made it into this exalted group, one had a hand span of 9 inches and the other had a hand span of 9.5 inches. The standard piano keyboard doesn't just make it harder for female pianists to match the level of acclaim reached by their male colleagues, it also affects their health. A range of studies carried out on instrumentalists during the 1980s and 90s found that female musicians suffered disproportionately from work-related injuries, and that keyboard players were among those most at risk. Several studies have found that female pianists run an approximately 50% higher risk of pain and injury than male pianists. In one study, 78% of women compared to 47% of men had developed RSI. It seems likely that this is related to hand size. Another study from 1984, which included only male pianists, identified 26 successful performers, defined as well-known soloists and winners of international competitions, and 10 problem cases. Those who had struggled with technical or injury problems over a long period. The former group's average hand span was 9.2 inches, compared to the problem case's 8.7 inches, which is nevertheless still substantially larger than the average female hand span. It was while Christopher Donison was practicing the coda of the G minor Chopin ballade on his Steinway Concert Grand for about the 1,000th time that he had the thought that led to his designing a new keyboard for people with smaller hands. What if it wasn't that his hands were too small, but that the standard keyboard was too large? The result of this thought was the 7/8 DS keyboard, which, Donison claimed, transformed his playing. I could finally use the correct fingerings. Broken chord formations could be played on one hand position instead of two. Wide, sweeping, left-hand arpeggiated figures so prevalent in romantic music became possible, and I could actually get on with the business of cultivating the right sound rather than repeatedly practicing the same passage. Donison's experience is backed up by numerous studies which have also found that a 7/8 keyboard dispels the professional and health disadvantages imposed by the conventional keyboard. And yet, there remains a strange, that is, if you don't accept that sexism is at play here, reluctance in the piano world to adapt. The reluctance to abandon design that suits only the largest male hands seems endemic. I remember a time back in the early 2000s when it was the smallest handsets that were winning phone measuring contests. That all changed with the advent of the iPhone and its pretenders. Suddenly, it was all about the size of your screen, and bigger was definitely better. The average smartphone is now 5.5 inches. And while we're admittedly all extremely impressed by the size of your screen, it's a slightly different matter when it comes to fitting into half the population's hands, not to mention minuscule or non-existent pockets. The average man can fairly comfortably use his device one-handed, but the average woman's hand is not much bigger than the handset itself. This is obviously annoying and foolish for a company like Apple, given that research shows women are more likely to own an iPhone than men. But don't expect to uncover a method to their madness anytime soon, because it's extraordinarily difficult to get any smartphone company to comment on their massive screen fixation. In desperation for answers, I turned to The Guardian's tech reporter Alex Hearn, but he couldn't help me either. It's a noted issue, he confirmed, but one I've never got a straight answer on. Speaking to people informally, he said the standard response was that phones were no longer designed for one-handed use. He's also been told that actually many women opt for larger phones, a trend that was usually attributed to handbags. And look, handbags are all well and good, but one of the reasons women carry them in the first place is because our clothes lack adequate pockets. So designing phones to be handbag-friendly rather than pocket-friendly feels like adding injury, more on this later, to insult. In any case, it's rather odd to claim that phones are designed for women to carry in their handbags when so many passive tracking apps clearly assume your phone will be either in your hands or in your pockets at all times, rather than sitting in your handbag on your office desk. I next turn to award-winning tech journalist and author James Ball, who has another theory for why the big screen fixation persists. Because the received wisdom is that men drive high-end smartphone purchases, women in fact don't figure in the equation at all. If this is true, it's certainly an odd approach for Apple to take, given the research about women being more likely to own iPhones. But I have another, more fundamental complaint with this analysis, because it again suggests that the problem is with women rather than male-biased design. In other words, if women aren't driving high-end smartphone purchases, is it because women aren't interested in smartphones, or could it be because smartphones are designed without women in mind? On the bright side, however, Ball reassured me that screens probably wouldn't be getting any bigger because they've hit the limit of men's hand size. Good news for men, then, but tough breaks for women like my friend Liz, who owns a third-generation Motorola Moto G. In response to one of my regular rants about handset sizes, she replied that she'd just been complaining to a friend about how difficult it was to zoom on my phone camera. He said it was easy on his. Turns out we have the same phone. I wondered if it was a hand size thing. Almost certainly it was. When Zeynep Tuveci, a researcher at the University of North Carolina, was trying to document tear gas use in the Gezi Park protests in Turkey in 2013, the size of her Google Nexus got in the way. It was the evening of the 9th of June. Gezi Park was crowded. Parents were there with their children. And then the canisters were fired. Because officials often claimed that tear gas was used only on vandals and violent protesters, Tuveci wanted to document what was happening. So she pulled out her phone. And as my lungs, eyes and nose burned with the pain of the lacrimatory agent released from multiple capsules that had fallen around me, I started cursing. Her phone was too big. She could not take a picture one-handed, something I had seen countless men with larger hands do all the time. All Tuveci's photos from the event were unusable, she wrote, and for one simple reason. Good smartphones are designed for male hands. Like the standard keyboard, smartphones designed for male hands also may be affecting women's health. It is a relatively new field of study, but the research that does exist on the health impact of smartphones is not positive. But although women's hand size is demonstrably smaller than men's, and although women have been found to have a higher prevalence of musculoskeletal symptoms and disorders, research into the impact of large smartphones on hands and arms does not buck the gender data gap trend. In the studies I found, women were significantly underrepresented as subjects, and the vast majority of studies did not sex disaggregate their data, including those that did manage to adequately represent women. This is unfortunate, because the few that did sex disaggregate their data reported a statistically significant gender difference in the impact of phone size on women's hand and arm health. The answer to the problem of smartphones that are too big for women's hands seems obvious. Design smaller handsets. And there are, of course, some smaller handsets on the market, notably Apple's iPhone SE. But the SE wasn't updated for 2 years, and so was an inferior product to the standard iPhone range, which offers only huge or huger as size options. And it's now been discontinued anyway. In China, women and men with smaller hands can buy the Kiku K1, which, with its hexagonal design, is trying to account for women's hand size. Good. But it has less processing power and comes with inbuilt airbrushing. Bad. Very bad. Voice recognition has also been suggested as a solution to smartphone-associated RSI, but this actually isn't much of a solution for women, because voice recognition software is often hopelessly male-biased. In 2016, Rachel Tapman, a research fellow in linguistics at the University of Washington, found that Google's speech recognition software was 70% more likely to accurately recognize male speech than female speech, and it's currently the best on the market. Clearly, it is unfair for women to pay the same price as men for products that deliver an inferior service to them. But there can also be serious safety implications. Voice recognition software in cars, for example, is meant to decrease distractions and make driving safer. But they can have the opposite effect if they don't work. And often, they don't work, at least for women. An article on car website Autoblog quoted a woman who had bought a 2012 Ford Focus, only to find that its voice command system only listened to her husband, even though he was in the passenger seat. Another woman called the manufacturer for help when her Buick's voice-activated phone system wouldn't listen to her. The guy told me point-blank it wasn't ever going to work for me. They told me to get a man to set it up. Immediately after writing these pages, I was with my mother in her Volvo Cross Country, watching her try and fail to get the voice recognition system to call her sister. After 5 failed attempts, I suggested she tried lowering the pitch of her voice. It worked first time. As voice recognition software has become more sophisticated, its use has branched out to numerous fields, including medicine, where errors can be just as grave. A 2016 paper analysed a random sample of 100 notes dictated by attending emergency physicians using speech recognition software and found that 15% of the errors were critical, potentially leading to miscommunication that could affect patient care. Unfortunately, these authors did not sex disaggregate their data, but papers that have report significantly higher transcription error rates for women than men. Dr. Saeed Ali, the lead author of one of the medical dictation studies, observed that his study's immediate impact was that women may have to work somewhat harder than men to make the voice recognition system successful. Rachel Tatman agrees. The fact that men enjoy better performance than women with these technologies means that it's harder for women to do their jobs. Even if it only takes a second to correct an error, those seconds add up over the days and weeks to a major time sink. Time your male colleagues aren't wasting messing with technology. Thankfully for frustrated women around the world, Tom Schalk, the vice president of voice technology at car navigation system supplier ATX, has come up with a novel solution to fix the many issues with women's voices. What women need, he said, was lengthy training, if only women were willing to submit to it. Which, sighs Schalk, they just aren't. Just like the willful women buying the wrong stoves in Bangladesh, women buying cars are unreasonably expecting voice recognition software developers to design a product that works for them when it's obvious that the problem needing fixing is the women themselves. Why can't a woman be more like a man? Rachel Tatman rubbishes the suggestion that the problem lies in women's voices rather than the technology that doesn't recognize them. Studies have found that women have significantly higher speech intelligibility, perhaps because women tend to produce longer vowel sounds and tend to speak slightly more slowly than men. Meanwhile, men have higher rates of disfluency, produce words with slightly shorter durations, and use more alternate, sloppy pronunciations. With all this in mind, voice recognition technology should, if anything, find it easier to recognize female rather than male voices. And indeed, Tatman writes that she has trained classifiers on speech data from women and they work just fine, thank you very much. Of course, the problem isn't women's voices. It's our old friend, the gender data gap. Speech recognition technology is trained on large databases of voice recordings called corpora. And these corpora are dominated by recordings of male voices. As far as we can tell, anyway, most don't provide a sex breakdown on the voices contained in their corpus, which in itself is a data gap, of course. When Tatman looked into the sex ratio of speech corpora, only TIMIT, the single most popular speech corpus in the Linguistic Data Consortium, provided data broken down by sex. It was 69% male. But contrary to what these findings imply, it is in fact possible to find recordings of women speaking. According to the data on its website, the British National Corpus, BNC, is sex balanced. Voice corpora are not the only male biased databases we're using to produce what turn out to be male biased algorithms. Text corpora, made up of a wide variety of texts from novels to newspaper articles to legal textbooks, are used to train translation software, CV scanning software, and web search algorithms. And they are riddled with gender data gaps. Searching the BNC, 100 million words from a wide range of late 20th century texts, I found that female pronouns consistently appeared at around half the rate of male pronouns. The 520 million word corpus of contemporary American English, COCA, also has a 2-to-1 male to female pronoun ratio, despite including texts as recent as 2015. Algorithms trained on these gap-ridden corpora are being left with the impression that the world actually is dominated by men. Image datasets also seem to have a gender data gap problem. a 2017 analysis of two commonly used datasets containing more than 100,000 images of complex scenes drawn from the web, labelled with descriptions, found that images of men greatly outnumber images of women. A University of Washington study similarly found that women were underrepresented on Google images across the 45 professions they tested, with CEO being the most divergent result. 27% of CEOs in the US are female, but women make up only 11% of the Google image search results. Searching for author also delivered an imbalanced result, with only 25% of the Google image results for the term being female, compared to 56% of actual US authors. And the study also found that, at least in the short term, this discrepancy did affect people's views of a field's gender proportions. For algorithms, of course, the impact will be more long-term. As well as underrepresenting women, these datasets are misrepresenting them. A 2017 analysis of common text corpora found that female names and words, woman, girl, etc., were more associated with family than career. It was the opposite for men. A 2016 analysis of a popular publicly available dataset based on Google News found that the top occupation linked to women was homemaker, and the top occupation linked to men was maestro. Also included in the top 10 gender-linked occupations were philosopher, socialite, captain, receptionist, architect, and nanny. I'll leave it to you to guess which were male and which were female. The 2017 image dataset analysis also found that the activities and objects included in the images showed a significant gender bias. One of the researchers, Mark Yatska, saw a future where a robot trained on these datasets who is unsure of what someone is doing in the kitchen offers a man a beer and a woman help washing dishes. These cultural stereotypes can be found in artificial intelligence, AI, technologies already in widespread use. For example, when Londa Scheibinger, a professor at Stanford University, used translation software to translate a newspaper interview with her from Spanish into English, both Google Translate and Systran repeatedly used male pronouns to refer to her, despite the presence of clearly gendered terms like profesora, female professor. Google Translate will also convert Turkish sentences with gender-neutral pronouns into English stereotypes. O bir doktor, which means she, he is a doctor, is translated into English as he is a doctor, while o bir hemşire, which means she, he is a nurse, is rendered she is a nurse. Researchers have found the same behaviour for translations into English from Finnish, Estonian, Hungarian and Persian. The good news is that we now have this data, but whether or not coders will use it to fix their male-biased algorithms remains to be seen. We have to hope they will, because machines aren't just reflecting our biases. Sometimes they are amplifying them, and by a significant amount. In the 2017 images study, pictures of cooking were over 33% more likely to involve women than men, but algorithms trained on this dataset connected pictures of kitchens with women 68% of the time. The paper also found that the higher the original bias, the stronger the amplification effect, which perhaps explains how the algorithm came to label a photo of a portly, balding man standing in front of a stove as female. Kitchen beats male pattern baldness. James Zhu, assistant professor of biomedical science at Stanford, explains why this matters. He gives the example of someone searching for computer programmer on a program trained on a dataset that associates that term more closely with a man than a woman. The algorithm could deem a male programmer's website more relevant than a female programmer's, even if the two websites are identical except for the names and gender pronouns. So a male-biased algorithm trained on corpora marked by a gender data gap could literally do a woman out of a job. But web search is only scraping the surface of how algorithms are already guiding decision-making. According to The Guardian, 72% of US CVs never reach human eyes, and robots are already involved in the interview process, with their algorithms trained on the posture, facial expressions, and vocal tone of top-performing employees. Which sounds great until you start thinking about the potential data gaps. Did the coders ensure that these top-performing employees were gender and ethnically diverse? And if not, does the algorithm account for this? Has the algorithm been trained to account for socialized gender differences in tone and facial expression? We simply don't know, because the companies developing these products don't share their algorithms. But let's face it, based on the available evidence, it seems unlikely. AI systems have been introduced to the medical world as well, to guide diagnoses, and while this could ultimately be a boon to healthcare, it currently feels like hubris. The introduction of AI to diagnostics seems to be accompanied by little to no acknowledgement of the well-documented and chronic gaps in medical data when it comes to women, and this could be a disaster. It could, in fact, be fatal, particularly given what we know about machine learning amplifying already existing biases. With our body of medical knowledge being so heavily skewed towards the male body, AIs could make diagnosis for women worse rather than better. And at the moment, barely anyone is even aware that we have a major problem brewing here. The authors of the 2016 Google News study pointed out that not a single one of the hundreds of papers about the applications for word association software recognized how blatantly sexist the datasets are. The authors of the image labeling paper similarly noted that they were the first to demonstrate structured prediction models amplify bias and the first to propose methods for reducing this effect. Our current approach to product design is disadvantaging women. It's affecting our ability to do our jobs effectively and sometimes to even get jobs in the first place. It's affecting our health and it's affecting our safety. And perhaps worst of all, the evidence suggests that when it comes to algorithm-driven products, it's making our world even more unequal. There are solutions.